All right, man. Welcome to Crow 777 Radio, episode 38. Jason Lindgren is back with me today. We're going to talk about space. I just got back from the West Coast. It was actually raining, a good rain in San Diego, which has been a bit unusual. There's been a drought out there for, something like 10 years. Don't know exactly how long, but there was quite a bit of rain coming down when I was out there. Needless to say, when I recorded this yesterday, I was a bit jet lagged. You'll hear Jason correct me on rear projection, front projection at one point, a bit punch drunk from the travel back. But anyhow, we're going to talk about space. And for so many people out there who have kind of figured out what the moon landings were, this is really kind of a starting point, in my view, to understanding that space and other things we've been told about rockets, it's just more deception. It's all it is. And if you come to understand what the moon landings are, your next logical progression will probably be to look at things like this. There's a lot of ways we could go at this, but what we kind of decided to do was lay down a timeline and address some of the things from all the way back in the Jules Verne era, where these novels of these kind of famous upper crust around the circles of royalty guys are writing books that are implanting the image of what space travel will look like in your mind. And this is, well before television, well before Star Trek. But it will give a person a chance to consider the timeline, and if they are so inclined, to go out and begin to research this. And it is my view that if anyone does this, they will begin to see that what they've been told falls apart. Now, I had mentioned not too long ago, I was actually stunned. I had gone outside one evening as fall. It was either late fall or early winter. It was getting cold. We had had very high winds here for, 3-4 days, something like that, a couple days anyhow. So there were no chemtrails. There was no moon in the sky, and I walked outside, and I could see the Milky Way perfectly. I'm far away from city lights here. The conditions and seeing were perfect. And all at once, I realized I was looking at the vault of the sky. And all these years of sky watching, even having been in the deserts and other places in Hawaii where the visibility is very good, for the first time it just hit me all at once. I could see what is referred to in old writings as the vault or the dome or the arch of the sky. People can see this under the right conditions. You need to have no moon. You need to be far away from city lights. You need to be in a place where chemtrails haven't been going nonstop, and you need to have good seeing. But when the Milky Way is visible, and you do have to be able to see the Milky Way, I would imagine, you can see it arc over the top of your head. And it's quite a thing to see. But to get back to the subject at hand, when you begin to look at space, and you begin to look at rockets, and you begin to research the footage, and you do it with an open mind, and you set aside the things you've been told for your whole life, when you set aside all the movies you've seen that set the expectation of what space is, you set all these things aside and you go at it methodically and logically, you will find that it's no different than almost any point in history you can look at. It does not add up to what you've been told. And when you consider, some of the work that I've done with the lunar wave and other things, from my point of view, that had a big bearing on when I began to realize all these things. It really started for me back in the 90s when I was shooting with film, trying to replicate what the supposed Hubble Space Telescope was producing, and I came to the realization it couldn't be done. And then, as I began to research more into the Hubble Space Telescope imagery, it was clear this was false color, this was a mosaic, these were all construct images. And while I could point my film camera back in the 90s through an SLR camera, hold the shutter open at, say, M42, the Orion Nebula, there is a light there in the shape you would expect it to be, but it's primarily red. And then I heard Fujifilm would give you greens and things like this, and I did all these things, and sure, I could get just a tiny bit of green in there, but it did not approach what we were being shown from the Hubble. And that's really when it began to fall apart. And in the modern era, coming to understand there is no Hubble Space Telescope. It's very likely that the Sophia aircraft has taken every images, although it has been demonstrated that a very good ground-based scope on top of a mountain could shoot images that can then be produced in the modern ways with Photoshop and other tools to look exactly like the Hubble images. It's been demonstrated. So anyhow, I wanted to mention one more thing. I was thinking about doing another episode on the false news cycles because they are such a thorn in the side of our existence. It is affecting so many people and bringing the consciousness of large groups of human beings very low with fear and fantasy and nonsense. So I went and I looked at some of the books that are being published because I wanted to understand, are there actually people publishing books that are telling the truth about these events? I grabbed one on Dallas, Baton Rouge. I grabbed one on, well, of course, Sandy Hoax has been outed, and the Boston bombing. And here's what I found. For the most part, they are saying flat out, these are lies, these were drills. They're going into great detail, actually telling pretty close to the truth. But then you get, using the Boston bombing as an example, you get to the point where they're talking about the supposed people who were supposed to have done the bombing, and they're saying that they were patsies. Now, in my view, this is nonsense. This is all a construct, and you're looking at actors. So, frustratingly, again, we are seeing people publishing books that are primarily telling the truth that these are false events, but then keeping in this nonsense that they're killing innocent people and having real people take the fall for this supposed event. It's very disheartening to see people coming so close to telling what I consider to be the truth. These are false events, and then getting the whole fear, violence dialectic back in it by claiming actually this innocent guy was killed and blamed for it and all this other nonsense. I will probably cover this in an upcoming episode because it's so critical to our times. Here we are in the new year, and we have to wonder, what's it going to be, man? Is it going to be another just roughshod run all the way through 2017 with false news cycle after false violence, after false shooting, it goes on and on and on. And it is my hope that more people wake up. And when I see books published like this, it's a double-edged sword for me. While it is communicating to people basically that it is false and probably in a decent way doing that, it never can get the whole story right, and that is such a frustrating thing because it leaves the taint of false violence, false death, and these other things on the stories. But anyhow, I came in jet-lagged, wanted to get this episode out because I needed to get an episode out, so I called Jason. We put together a list to walk through the timeline of space. This is not just a gimme for people. We're going to draw a timeline for people who truly want to understand something. If you take a look at the things we are talking about, you will come to the conclusion. I know you will. If you logically look at it and you set aside the nonsense you've been told your whole life, from schools to space agencies to everything else. And again, in my view, space agencies, all of them, they all share the vector logo in their, the vector symbol in their logos. They all exist above government in the same little club that exists for one reason, in my view: to ensure that the average person on the face of this world knows nothing about what is above the blue sky they can see. So having said that, let's jump in. All right, man. Welcome to Crow 777 Radio Podcast. This is episode 38. I have Jason Lindgren back with me from Secrets of Saturn, and we will be covering space. There's a lot of ways we could go at space to kind of show you that it's a construct and the descriptions of space that we've been given do not match the reality that we can decipher. As a person who spent a lot of time behind a telescope, there are things that I could talk about that the average person might not be able to relate to so well, other than maybe looking at some of my footage, but that doesn't really get it. So what we're going to do here is draw kind of a timeline and try to give the average person enough information that if they choose to go challenge this and look at it, they can come to the conclusion that basically space is the fraud of generations. It all starts with media, and it does not matter whether it's pre-media that we have today, like televisions and things like this, even if we're just talking about stories, novels, books, even back to Jules Verne, we are going to draw the picture that shows how the image of space has been implanted into the world consciousness and how it's been maintained through the years. And just before I get Jason in here, I would point out, anytime you can look at any given event
and take the numbers that are being associated or thrown in your face, and you can use simple numerology to reduce them to 9/11. You should understand what's going on. We will get into this a bit more, but Star Trek is one of the major implanters of the image of space we all have in our minds. And few people are aware that, right, the hull number on the Starcraft Enterprise is, excuse me, NCC 1701. Well, NCC adds up to 11. And the CC also encodes the number 33. For those who follow me, they understand whose thumbprint that is. But the 1701, of course, adds to 9. So right on the Star Trek Enterprise hull is 9/11 encoded. And that is the first kind of clue that I will drop to you that shows it is all nonsense. And it has been nonsense from the outset. Anyhow, let's get Jason in here. Jason, how are you, bud?
I'm doing great, man. How are you, buddy?
Good, man. How are anything new in the new year with you?
Yeah, I'm working on music again, for one thing, but I've been working on my own show as well. I just finished something with Dr. Johan Oldenkamp from the Netherlands, I believe he is. Really interesting fellow, doing translations from the original Greek biblical texts, so that was fascinating, and I got a couple more guys lined up. I've actually been having listeners write to me, and one of them is actually going to be an amazing guest of mine, hopefully coming up in this month, to... He does a lot of esoteric, kind of like what you were just talking about with the numbers and everything. He does a huge breakdown of the JFK assassination with occult numerology and all that. Really interesting stuff, so he's going to be coming on with me.
That's cool, and of course the JFK hoax assassination has the 33 thumbprint on it because it was executed right off the 33rd parallel, as was Roswell, the whole alien agenda thing. Of course, the Tavistock people take complete... responsibility for the alien agenda as it's shown up in movies. But anyhow, we've got quite a list to get through here. So what I think I'll do is I'll just kick it right over to you and let's jump in.
Right. So what I thought we should do here when we were talking about space fraud and it's the social engineering aspects of it, it's everywhere. So I thought I would start with what I saw as the earliest but current aspects of that, which is the Victorian era with the author Jules Verne being the first real major science fiction writer along with H.G. Wells. So we have Jules Verne putting out his book From the Earth to the Moon, which utilizes a space gun, a cannon shooting a projectile that would carry three people into space. It was kind of almost like a command module or sort of like the space shuttle in design. And on board, they had all the necessities of life on board for the journey. And this kind of set up the very early notions of what a spacecraft could and should be like into the public eye. So they have this craft. This is the way it needs to be done because space is like this, and this is what you would need to survive there.
Right. And I think the critical thing that I see here is we can absolutely demonstrate that so many of the big mainstream sci-fi writers actually end up inventing so many of the technologies that we are now showing to be fraud, like satellites. As an example, and I always get this wrong, I don't know if it's Isaac Asimov or the other guy.
Arthur C. Clarke, I believe.
Yes, Arthur C. Clarke or Asimov, I forget which one, actually invents modern telecommunications and the satellite. Well, anyone who's followed my work, I have spent a lot of time trying to demonstrate to people that nothing goes above what we call low Earth orbit, and that would not even be what we consider space, whatever it is, and there are no satellites. And yet, so in the same way that the Church of Scientology was invented from a science fiction writer, so many of even nuclear stuff, nukes, come out of sci-fi writing. So what you're pointing out here with Jules Verne is part and parcel of these kind of upper crust, probably many of them not too far away from the royal family or the elite, writing these novels and these science fiction ideas that actually become later on what people believe to be true.
Right. And Jules Verne pretty much starts that, lays the groundwork, and then immediately we have H.G. Wells writing the book The Shape of Things to Come. And in 1936, a movie is made of it that I believe he actually took part with, Things to Come, and there's actually nukes used in that movie.
Right.
Now, in 1936, there weren't officially nukes yet, so there you go, backing up the statement you just made a moment ago. And this movie ends with the shooting, again, of a manned projectile into space utilizing an electric gun, and it's supposed to be the great achievement of mankind after decades of horrific war and destruction and the nuclear fallout and all that stuff. An interesting point also, in 1936, that's the acknowledged year of the founding of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, or JPL, at the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena, California. So interesting tie-in there as well.
All right. And of course, 1936 is another basic numerology in code. The number 36 is meant to represent 666. And the reason for that is that if you take every digit from 1 to 36 and add them together, you come up with 666. So quite typically, 1936, usually they leave off the century and they encode, in my view, a lot just the year. So 36 would encode 666. But I mean, even when we get into JPL, absolutely, we were just talking about the Church of Scientology, and there is the Church of Scientology creator, L. Ron Hubbard, hovering around the creation of JPL. And there have been many accounts how the three main groups that started JPL were Masons, and there were a lot of them, supposed people from Nazi Germany, and then people that were referred to as magicians, and this would have been the L. Ron Hubbard set, and I can't remember the guy's name. Parson? I think it's
Jack Parson.
Jack Parsons. Yeah, Jack Parsons. These are the guys that are involved, and so we have the same cast of characters. And H.G. Wells, I mean, anyone who wants to kind of see a real insider, and there seems to be some Tavistock ties from the work Wells did. Do you know when he was born, by the way? Do you have any idea what era?
He was born in the Victorian era, but he I can get to the year real quick. But he was part of all the upper crust clubs and all that.
Right.
He was involved with all of that in the Victorian era and then into the Edwardian era. And he just – it's obvious that he rubbed shoulders with the kind of people who were manipulating society. He was born in 1866 and died in 46. So there you go. He was involved with all of that early groundwork being laid down.
So there you go. You know, just prior to his death, the people who end up making the Tavistock Institute, who are playing on Jung and Freud's very right-wing ideas, very kind of – I don't even know how to put a label on it. It's beyond – It's beyond what our ideas of Nazis would be. But they take these ideas and they start the mind sciences or the sociological sciences, which begin to program our existence. And many of these authors are, you know, like the guy who wrote Animal Farm, Brave New World, 1984. All these people are in the sphere of influence of the people who are creating Tavistock. So when we think about JPL and we think about H.G. Wells, we're looking at part and parcel of the Boys Club, who are fashioning the image of the reality that in the modern era the average person believes in, what space should look like, what it would be like to travel to a supposed planet, these ideas. That's what these people are up to. And for my money, they're making it up out of whole cloth. They're doing it to deny the average citizen of this world understanding of where it is they are, where their center is, where it is they exist. And that sets aside how we got here or how long we've been here, any of these other things. But anyhow, I'll let you keep moving down the road.
An interesting note that George Orwell, or his real name was Eric Blair, also ran in some of these circles and was obviously privy to a lot of information that, you know, most people would not be. So it seems that Brave New World, or excuse me, not Brave New World, 1984, was almost like he was saying, hey, watch out. This is what they got in mind. And
that's right.
And in the book, there's rocket launches. You know, they're dropping rockets on the civilian population to keep the never-ending war going. So that notion is also injected even in that book.
Right. And of course, the never-ending war is a fraud. There is no such thing as a never-ending war. It's just a means of control. And you point out a very critical thing here. Animal Farm demonstrates flat out how some of the ways they manipulate a world population. Brave New World is a blueprint for where we are headed, flat out. And these, again, are directly from the outskirts of the Tavistock Institute setup, who is attributed as one of the main programmers of our society. And then, of course, 1984 is, as you stated, it's kind of a long mirror reflection of what things may become.
Right, and that comes out in 1948, and then we get up to 1950, and then there's a pretty major motion picture released. Even though science fiction isn't really a popular thing yet, we have a movie called Destination Moon, and its success sets the stage for the massive sci-fi craze that now starts going on in the 1950s into the 1960s. We have tons of films coming out that all seem to have a very similar tone and feel. Some of it was about alien invasion. Some of it was just all about space travel and all that. But this is where we really see this, what they call the space age kicking off. They all seem to be saying the same thing. Even the alien invasions are very similar, and the aliens look very similar. Like, it's all, you could tell, this is just being churned out to just drive home this same notion over and over and over again.
Right. What they're doing is they're playing from a pre-planned script. They're going to create an image in the mind of everyone of what aliens are, you know. And I've said it a lot of times, it upsets a lot of people, but the alien agenda is flat out shown to be invented by the Tavistock Institute. Now, whether or not there are other beings out there, I can't answer these things, but I can say I don't see direct evidence for it. And I filmed a lot of weird things. But to get back to the space thing, it's really no different than what happened with the Wild West. If you went out into the world and asked people what their thoughts on, you know, how the American Wild West was, you'd basically get a version of the Buffalo Bill Cody show, you know, that toured around America. And it is the furthest thing from factual actuality of what we know about how the West in America was lived in and how it was advanced. Well, moving into the space age, the same thing is going on. They are basing science fiction novels. They're basing at some point when they get up to film media and these other things. You know, it reminds me, Jason, there's a movie, I think it was the first big budget sci-fi. Is it called 50 Million Miles from Earth? It's called something like that. But they go to this planet to find a professor who's...
Oh, that's, The Fantastic Planet.
Is that what it is?
I believe so. I'll double check right now, but I believe it had Leslie Nielsen in it. That's the one you're referring to, right?
Right. It does have Leslie Nielsen, and of course there's a professor there who's Walter Pidgeon plays the professor, and he has found ancient alien technology. And so from the very onset of the first big motion picture, and it's a great picture, even today it holds up, they're implanting the ideas of the flying saucer, what space travel should look like, what it would look like if you could approach a planet, what it should look like when you're leaving a planet, all this imagery, which is basically, you know, it almost takes on a religious overtone. If we were to go back in time before we had all this modern media, when men and women came together to really concentrate on a thing, it would have a lot to do with religion back in the day, whether it was a church or pre-churches, whatever you're talking about. But that's kind of the gap that these movies are filling. You see, they're painting this picture that most of us look at as just imagery, but it's much more than that. It is shaping the way we think about the place we live, and that is kind of a form of magic.
Right. The movie was Forbidden Planet, a fantastic
planet.
There it
is.
1956.
Exactly.
And what's interesting about Forbidden Planet, it almost set up the groundwork for Star Trek, because it was a military-esque kind of vessel coming to this planet, exploring and going through, you know, the misadventure that the plot unfolds. Seems very, very similar that's where Star Trek came from.
Well, there's another thing I noticed. I had watched that movie recently. The movie still holds up. It's an interesting movie to watch, and the special effects are spectacular for the time. But it is the first big-budget sci-fi flick. One of the things you'll notice is the, as you mentioned, the military crossover. And it's not just any military, it's Navy. You will see so often that anything that has to do with space, like rocket ships or spaceships, are named after old sailing ships. Well, in the movie, of course, you have your bosun and you have your cook, and it is totally sea-oriented. And for people who have followed along, they would understand that actually our modern law system, of course, is heavily influenced by the idea of maritime law and admiralty law. But you can see these archetypes being built from the ground up all the way to, you know, where you're pointing out, the 50s and 60s, as motion pictures begin to cover the space fraud.
Right. The 1950s, and especially the 1960s, as we've spoken about at length before, seems to really be the massive shift in social engineering about where they're going to take things for the future. You know, they have the huge visions of the past being portrayed. If you remember that, they had tons of Wild West movies and shows and things like that. That was a huge thing in the 50s and 60s. And even Star Trek was supposed to be the wagon train to the stars, because that was still hugely popular at the time. And as you stated earlier, they created an image that is probably extremely far from the reality of what really went on with the early pioneers going out that way. I always, as an adult, would assume that if you were founding a bunch of towns out in the middle of nowhere, it would probably suck big time. It would be, you know, smelly, and you probably didn't have a lot of good food. The water wouldn't be great. You know, you're literally building from scratch. I'm sure it was an incredibly rough existence.
Yeah, you would have to imagine. And if you had a society that was basically the gun decided everything, you've got to begin to question, how would that ever work? And the truth, you know, that's what I think is closer to the truth. They're demonstrating that actually women had a hell of a lot more to do with the founding of the Western frontier than men did. And that is starting to be a more realistic, believable picture. But you mentioned that all this was being planned out. It's not just planned out. It is planned out to a T. As an example, we were talking about the book 1984 and what date starts that? 48. Well, 48 is the mirror of 84. So it's all encoded numerically, and it's all got this numerology gematria game that is played everywhere. And it's a bit like a computer program where there's a foundational computer program with all these subroutines that are numerically coded, which relates them to one starting point or an ending point or one exercise versus another. It is all put together that way. And to be honest, it is quite astonishing to consider that somewhere in this world, there are a group of people who laid down this footwork.
Oh, totally. And as we've discussed with other media, the 1960s, the mid to late 60s, seems to be where the really big shifts happened, because they were doing it in music and movies and just the culture in general with all the assassinations and all of the things that were going on. It seems that the 60s was the time that they really took things and grabbed it and yanked it into a different direction. But before we get into the 60s, the mainstream global space program begins in 1957 with the announcement from the Soviet Union that they put Sputnik 1 satellite into orbit. Then the following year is in 58 is supposed to be NASA's founding, and then they make the satellite claim as well with Explorer 1.
I think what you're getting ready to point out is, I mean, even if we jump forward to the JFK speech where we're going to go to the moon, I mean, basically nobody's been anywhere that matters. You know, we haven't been to space a bunch of times. I guess at that point, Yuri Gagarin in 61 is supposed to have orbited. We're told a dog and a monkey and a mouse or something have been shot up there. Some of them died. Some of them supposedly did not. My point being, the president of the United States, John F. Kennedy, stands up, says we're going to the moon, when in fact there's no basis to make that statement. You know, we haven't been anywhere. There is no foundational ground to stand on from here. We live on Earth, and by the way, we're going to this other place, and we really haven't even been to space yet.
Right. That's the interesting thing. Soviets claimed the first one in 61 with Yuri Gagarin. JFK makes a speech after that that they're going to the moon before the decade is out. But NASA hasn't done anything yet. But they're already making this insane leap that we're going to do this incredible thing. And then they orbit John Glenn in 62.
So, of course,
you know, so that begins the whole NASA fraud of what they're going to be doing all throughout the 60s.
And this whole episode that we're talking about now really begins to underline the fraud for anyone who can think. First off, you're looking at a president who has never had any experience in space to mention that matters. And he's saying we're going to go to the moon in less than 10 years. And they pull it off, if we're to believe what we were told, which I do not. Okay. Now let's go to Bush the Jr., who at the end of his presidency says, guess what? We're going back to the moon. Well, it never happens. So with all the modern technology and everything else, you can see the problem here. So back in the 60s, they didn't have computers. They didn't have experience in space. They didn't have anything. And yet they're telling us, oh, yeah, with all this, you know, minuscule technology, we put a guy up there and brought him back alive. And yet, 40, 50 years later, still nothing. You know, the Chinese are claiming they're on the moon right now. And it's just more nonsense. You know, as soon as the Chinese, what was it, Chang 3? I think we would call it Change 3 if we read it in English. And of course, that Chang idea relates to a myth that has to do with the moon, as so much of the Apollo missions do. What you're looking at here is multinational fraud. In other words, when you see a space agency, and you notice the logo for that space agency, you will see a vector symbol in every single one of them. It does not matter if it's Iran, China, US, anyone with a space agency has this vector symbol. The vector symbol in my eyes almost demonstrates this club that operates so far above government. Because in the same way that JFK made the speech that we were going to the moon, in the same way NASA lied about the Apollo moon landings, China is doing it right now. And the funny thing is they are unafraid, because not only did they take the Chinese rover up there and immediately the video failed and people started calling out all these problems because the details will kill any one of these frauds, they're already announcing Chang 5 or Change 5, whatever you want to call it, is going to be, I think this year maybe, approaching the moon again. So it is not only full spectrum coverage through novels, through movies, through media, but you have all the countries who are in the space game complicit in drawing the illusion that the majority of the world uses as their actual view of what is real.
Right. And all once we get into the 60s, the space thing is everywhere. In books, in comic books, television, films, like it's completely saturated. And it's the same concept over and over and over again about what space is like, what planetary bodies are like, what the universe is like. So throughout the 60s, we have all these supposed launches on both sides of the Cold War factions. The USSR claims to have the first spacewalk in 65 with Alexei Leonov. And then a few months later, NASA claims it again with Ed White. 65 is also the year of the first released Mars pictures from Mariner 4, and this is where we start seeing all of these images coming out of all these planetary bodies. And, you know, they release pictures of the moon, they release pictures of Mars, and this is setting up for, obviously, for later on, the concept of what these planetary bodies are like.
That's right, and Mars is a really good example. I actually went to the Lowell Observatory and looked through that big, I think it's a 27-inch scope, maybe I've forgotten, just a beautiful, beautiful image. Looked at the moon through that. They wouldn't let us look at anything but one crater, but the optics were stunning. Now, here is a key point to make on what you just said. So the pictures of Mars start to come out. Early on, there was this idea that there were canali or channels on Mars, and some people were pushing that they had to be built by living beings and others that they were natural features, but there was a real push to convince people there were canals on Mars and that people had built them. Funny thing is, there were a bunch of early observers, some of them with really big scopes, seeing this. And I looked through the scope of the man who spent 10 years, Percival Lowell, staring at Mars and mapping these supposed channels, which, by the way, no longer exist. If you look up anything on Mars, you will see that, well, Lowell was seeing phantasms or these other things. But there were a couple other people. Giovanni was one. I've forgotten their names, who were confirming what Lowell said. As a matter of fact, some of them were predecessors to Lowell in this idea. Well, then all of a sudden, Giovanni, or one of those guys over in Europe, gets into the Royal Astronomical Society and gets given access to a 33-inch scope, and then he recants on the channels idea on Mars. And so this idea of Mars, the picture being seeded out to the world, persists until Lowell's death. And then they begin to recant, saying, oh, there were no channels, it was a mistake, these people didn't know what they were seeing, and they even did all these experiments to show how people can hallucinate. But here's the rub. And I think it was 62 or 63, you can actually go into Google Mars, and I think it's one of the layovers you can use. There is a U.S. Air Force map of Mars that shows the canali, the channels. In the early 60s, this is still going on. So you can see how an image is produced and then, in this case, cast aside for a different image that we're now all supposed to believe in as Mars.
Right. And for whatever reason, they decided that this is the image they're going to portray, and that's what they start bombarding us with.
Yeah, I mean, there is no better example than Mars right now. I remember not too long ago, a year or two ago, when they announced there's likely water on Mars. Well, that happened, I think, on a Monday. Sometimes I get this backwards, so I'm going to say Monday and Friday. I think I've got them right, but if I get them backwards, I apologize. They were going to announce on a Monday, they did announce on a Monday, that they had found that, yeah, likely there's water on Mars. That Friday, Matt Damon's major motion picture of The Martian releases. So you can see the full spectrum control. And to take that a step further, I was in San Diego at the time. They began playing nonstop Elton John's Rocket Man, David Bowie's Space Oddity. This was going on across three or four rock stations in multiple rotations a day, and all these other kind of very popular songs that have to do with space. So you can see, even up to now, the push that's going on with Mars to get you to believe there is a place called Mars and we are going there. National Geographic has a television series going out on it. It is regularly showing up in National Geographic magazine. The Sky and Telescope magazine that I get just to keep track of what nonsense they're pushing this week is pushing it. So, I mean, it is literally an organized, full-spectrum approach to put the image of what Mars and what a Mars mission should look like into the minds of the people. And I'm here to tell you, it's all fraud. We will never go to Mars, and Mars does not exist in the way it's been described to us.
Yeah, what's interesting about everything you just said, I've been watching a lot of the film that's been released from all of these launches in the 60s, and the one thing that jumps out at me massively is that things just don't look consistent from program to program. You know, Mercury, Gemini, Apollo, and all that, the Earth especially looks different.
Right. I mean, there's no getting away from it. You know what I used to do is if you go to a search engine and you start to look up some of the earliest images of the moon you can find, what's astounding is it looks so darn 3D. Now, as a person who spent many thousands of hours and years filming the moon with both video and stills through all phases, fully lit, partially lit, everything in between, I have never, ever been able to capture an image that shows this kind of three-dimensionality of the early moon images. And this takes us back to what you're talking about, the Earth. Now, this is a key point. The blue marble image that showed up in textbooks all over this world to seed in the mind of this world what Earth should look like from space is a fraud image. It's attributed to the Apollo 17 crew. For some reason, since the 70s, or maybe that was the 60s, I don't know, it was the 70s.
72, I believe.
Yeah, when that image was supposedly snapped from space of the world, we didn't get any more images of Earth from space. That same Apollo 17 image has been everywhere ever since, and it's proven to be a fraud. It's a construct. There have been a couple other images since recently put out that show supposed Earth from space, but immediately the average eye can see that the land masses have changed shape and size and all these other things. So it's a crazy, crazy thing. And for the average person to begin to challenge things at the level that we're throwing down here, you really need to start somewhere. And I would suggest the Apollo 17 image of Earth from space is a good place for someone who's new to this to start. It's an admitted construct. There is no snapshot anywhere of Earth from space, and you can demonstrate this by looking.
The rotation is another thing I noticed, like in the images, like the early 60s launches released by NASA. The Earth is rotating super fast.
Right.
You know, and it just doesn't look the same when you look at like the more modern stuff, and you look at the space shuttle image, the last of the space shuttle launches, and the ISS stuff that they show, in the early stuff, and the first spacewalk I was watching, I kept rewatching it. It looks like the Earth is just like spinning like crazy. It's like it doesn't look that way at all in later images. So, you know, it's I don't know, man. It's so glaringly obvious that it's ridiculous.
It's glaringly obvious if you get to a point where you understand that the details of any lie will destroy the lie. In other words, a hoax like this will die under the weight of its own details. Now, the cloud thing, to get back to the Apollo 17 image called the blue marble so often of Earth from space, which is a fraud image, people have now gone through that image and demonstrated that the cloud formations in that snapshot were just cloned. They're identical. There's like 6 or 7 or 8 spots where the exact same cloud formation was cloned back into the picture as if they were using Photoshop in the days this happened. And not only that, you made a good point there. There are actually these very fuzzy, bad images of a supposed spacecraft imaging the Earth spinning with the moon rotating around it. And it makes the point perfectly that you were just alluding to. The Earth is just hauling butt on a full tilt spin, and yet every other image you ever see of Earth, there will be problems. And that includes these supposed ISS shots. You know, one thing we know as a rule, a law, from perspective in art class, is that if we were flying over the Earth, the clouds that are furthest from us would be moving very slowly. And as the Earth rotated under us from the ISS perspective, if there was such a place, and there is not, as the clouds became closer to us, they would move more quickly, and the gaps between them would become wider and wider. In other words, clouds way far away on a rotating body that we were supposedly orbiting would be moving very slowly with very narrow gaps between them. The closer they got to you, the slower they would appear to, or the quicker they would appear to move, and the gaps would widen out. This proves flat out the fraud of all the ISS imagery and so many other things. And then, of course, there's the whole litany of supposed shots of the United States from the ISS at night. There's no lights. I mean, it goes on and on. The details will absolutely kill the idea that we have anything in space taking pictures of this planet.
Yeah, and anybody who doesn't believe us, just go ahead and do what I did. Look at the earliest NASA releases. Go through time. This is what I did. I went through Mercury, Gemini, then Apollo. I looked at all of them, and it's just things look different. You know, you don't have to exactly take Crow's word for it. You can do this on your own. Look at the images. This is what I did. I don't know what it means. All I can say is there's glaring inconsistencies, and I'm sorry, the planet shouldn't be changing within a year's time.
That's right. And the other thing people should keep in mind is that an aircraft that's flying at 70,000 feet, which apparently can be done, will take images that would be nearly identical from what we would expect to see from a place like the International Space Station if there was such a place. And I maintain there is not such a place. So even a very high-flying altitude plane could be providing some imagery that is actually real.
Well, there's tons of people who also do weather balloon launches and release the footage, you know?
Right. Right.
And this is what really got me. The Earth doesn't look like what it did on the images that I watched from Ed White's spacewalk in 1965 or whatever it was. You know, it's like, well, how is that even possible?
No, it's night and day. That's actually a good point, Jason. I would urge people to go look at all the weather balloon footage where people are putting a camera, putting a balloon up as high as they can, some trying to demonstrate the shape of the Earth, others just to do it, and you will notice that the imagery you get is vastly different from the supposed images that we're supposed to be getting from space.
Now, going through the 60s, we come up to 1968, and this movie that is released in 1968, 2001 A Space Odyssey, there is a lot to say about it. Not only is it the absolute most amazing science fiction production up to this point. The effects were absolutely unparalleled for when it came out, and really nothing really touched it up until Star Wars in 77. But this was made by Stanley Kubrick. The movie depicts man venturing to the outer solar system in regards to contact with basically what are alien obelisks. You know, the monolith, they are representational of the black cube, it would seem, symbolically. The one big inconsistency a lot of people don't realize, because a lot of people don't read anymore, in the book of this, written by Arthur C. Clarke, they go to Saturn.
Right.
In the movie, it's been switched to Jupiter. Now, the claim is that they couldn't get the special effects of the rings to look right, and Kubrick was so anal about getting everything so amazing that he couldn't do it. I accept that as a possibility. The other side of that would be that it was a little too obvious if they said Saturn instead of Jupiter on film. And I don't think we need to go into a huge thing about how important Saturn is to the elite agenda and what it represents.
No, I mean, it's been covered ad nauseum, but, you know, the whole here's just a tidbit for anyone who wants to take this apart. Did you know that at Ground Zero, in the 9/11 footprint where all the false flag event went on, the demolition of those two buildings, there is a hotel there called the Millennium. The Hilton Millennium, I believe it's called, and it is an actual reconstruction of the obelisk from Stanley Kubrick's 2001.
Right. The proportions were done right, and, you know, that should just tell you something.
Well, of course. Of course it should tell you something. But the thing about Kubrick was that it's been pretty demonstrated the amount of encoding he did in every movie he ever made. But in terms of 2001, very few people know, when it first was released, when the end credits rolled, there were all these thank yous and nods to NASA, to JPL, to all these places at the end of that movie who had helped make it possible. If you look at that movie today, every one of those credits has been lifted. But he went on to do another movie after that. I think it's called Barry Lyndon.
Yes.
So Barry Lyndon was done, and he wanted this to have a certain look. Did you know that he went to NASA and asked for this one-of-a-kind camera lens to get the look for that movie that made it so famous, the Ryan O'Neill movie, who plays the lead character? Kubrick went to NASA and asked for a special lens that only he could get and use, and it just demonstrates what's going on here. But if we go back and look at Kubrick's possible involvement in the moon landing, you'll quickly find out that, well, the problem here is people have to have a little technical expertise in terms of knowing how video works. But in every single moonshot that you can look at, nearly every one of them, there's a cut line where there's a horizon or sand or gray ground where there's a cut line and you can see where they can insert the rear projection of the background. And this was done to so many images, and I saw this years and years ago, that I fully understood, because I was a video guy, that this was wholesale fraud. Well, years later, when I had set up my YouTube channel, there was someone had sent me a link to a website from the Soviet Union or somewhere like that. I've forgotten exactly. Maybe it was the Ukraine. It's called Aulis.com, AULIS.com. And there's a PhD there who worked for one of the big universities at one time, who took stereoscopic method and applied it to just tons of NASA images. And he flat out shows that all the moon landing imagery that we were handed, all of it, was shot on a soundstage. And he can show the formulas that he used to do the stereoscopic spectroscopy. I forget what it's called. It's a stereoscopic method where you take two images and blink them, and it allows you to do the geometry basically to determine how far things in the background are. One example was that there was a shot taken where the mountains behind the supposed astronauts was supposed to be 5 kilometers away. He did his method, shows the formula so that it could be replicated any day of the week, and it's basically something like 500 feet away. This is incontrovertible evidence. This is math. You can't really argue these points, but I think that just the fact that they ripped out all the NASA credits from 2001, and then his next movie, Barry Lyndon, he goes to NASA to get, you know, a lens that no one else in the world could get, is pretty damning on the face of it.
Oh, it totally is. Now, there is no direct smoking gun saying that, yes, Stanley Kubrick was in bed with NASA and faked the moon landings. What there is, however, because I've looked into this quite a lot, there is so much circumstantial evidence that it's almost incontrovertible. So the production of 2001 takes place over 4 years. It also takes place at the same time as the development of the Apollo program.
Exactly.
And you're correct that at the end of the original release of 2001, there are tons of credits with all these NASA people, and there's actually pictures of it too. They were flying back and forth from where 2001 was being filmed in England and to the United States. Now, Arthur C. Clarke was there as well. He's a known insider with a lot of the elite crowd and all that. So there's all this, what seems to be dirty dealings going on between all these people. Now, whether Stanley Kubrick was just a brilliant movie maker and they got him involved, or whether he was involved with things on a higher level, nobody really knows. But his last movie, Eyes Wide Shut, certainly kind of gave us a hint that he at least knew about a lot of the evil crap that goes on.
Well, even in The Shining, Jason, I mean, there's the shot in the hallway of the little bit. Here's a couple things. When I had researched The Shining, I had done this right as the movie, I forget, room 223. I don't remember the room number, but there's a movie documentary that breaks apart The Shining that shows what Kubrick was up to. In The Shining, the little boy Danny is in a hallway and he's sitting on a carpet with a rug, has a certain pattern, and he's playing with these trucks. And this ball rolls into frame. As the kid stands up, he's wearing a sweater with the Apollo 11 rocket on the front of it. Well, just by chance, I guess we're supposed to believe, the pattern on the carpet is identical to the Cape Canaveral launch pad pattern. And this goes on and on in the movie The Shining. There's another portion where there was a 1960s Tang commercial that ran in the 60s in black and white and color on TV, where a can of Tang is eclipsed, so the shadow makes the front of the can of Tang look a certain way. At one point in The Shining, Kubrick, who was known to set his sets up very particularly, had all these cans of Tang lined up so that they were eclipsed in exactly the same way, so that the appearance of the front of the Tang can matched perfectly the Apollo 11 Tang commercial.
Right, and it is documented fact that Stanley Kubrick was obsessive about getting his shots exactly the way he wanted them. He would literally, every single detail he would decide ahead of time and would do reshoot after reshoot after reshoot. And a lot of actors have said that it was quite grueling to work for him. A lot of people did it because they respected him so much and knew that what came out afterwards would be a masterpiece. But it is absolutely known that if it was shown in that shot, he put it there exactly the way it is seen. That is what he wanted. The mere fact that the little boy Danny is wearing an Apollo 11 sweater, that was decided by Stanley Kubrick, and that and the way it's seen and all of that was absolutely decided specifically by Stanley Kubrick.
That's right. And they have the little boy stand up, making it look like the rocket is leaving the launch pad. The pattern on the floor exactly matches the Cape Canaveral thing. But in my mind, to cut to the chase here, there is no doubt that what 2001 was about was to get the technology in place that NASA needed to fake the moon landing. People can show that there's no direct evidence, but the problem here is there is so much circumstantial evidence that at some point it just becomes overwhelming. You cannot cast it aside. You know, it's a bit like, you know, I saw someone covering the other day, they have, what do they call it when a museum takes an artifact and they, you know, put it on display and they make sure it's all taken care of? I forget the word for it, but Neil Armstrong's suit, the one that stepped on the moon, is on display. Did you know that people are now demonstrating, if you look at the bottom of the boot on that suit, it doesn't match the footprint that he supposedly left on the moon? It goes on and on and on. There's no getting away from it.
Yeah, I'd love to have that. I'd like to have someone actually get that and say, like, without a doubt, you know, maybe walk up with an iPhone or something like that and get it all on film and be like, hey, this is what they're claiming, and here's the picture of the moon. Like, let's definitively knock that one out of the ballpark.
I think it's pretty much been done. I mean, because at some point, if they understood it was going to be a problem and they changed it, you know, there's going to be images of the suit before it's changed. Although I imagine they'll probably create some elaborate story how there was some other part of the uniform that we weren't aware of, or who knows. But it's these details that just completely demonstrate that space travel in the era of the moon landings is a complete farce. It's just made up nonsense.
Now, to tie up the 2001 whole situation, there is a very excellent documentary. In fact, there's two of them, and I think a third one is coming out by the researcher, author, filmmaker Jay Widener. And I've seen the two he's released, where he goes into very specific details about all the things we just discussed. And what it comes down to is Stanley Kubrick was the master at what was called front screen projection. And what that is, this was the precursor to blue screen and green screen techniques that would start coming into heavy use in the 70s, which was more effective and basically less of a pain in the ass to do. You could do a lot more with it. And what it was is you would have an image projected behind the actors so that you could have actors walk around in front of it, but it was really close to looking almost perfect. And this technique is used repeatedly in 2001 A Space Odyssey. And what Jay Widener and others have demonstrated is that the same techniques where they have to hide the screen line.
Right.
With, you know, on set, you would have to have something covering up the fact that there's a screen behind the actors. Well, what's demonstrated over and over and over again is that you can tell where they would have done that in the moon shots.
That's what I was pointing out, what I was calling cut lines. So basically what Jason's saying, and just so people understand how this technology is used, you've seen it a million times in old movies. Let's take any 50s era movie where the people are driving in a car. They're sitting in a car that's not moving, and there's a front projection going on behind them. So there's a screen behind the car that shows all the traffic and everything going on to make it look like the car is moving. The image is projected onto the screen through the back of the screen so that everyone can stand in front of the screen without the projection getting in the way. I hope I described that properly.
Well, actually, you're getting those wrong. The 50s style is called rear projection. And look, if you look at it, it's the film is several generations older. That's why it looks kind of washed out and the lighting doesn't match up. The big thing about front screen projection is you don't have that issue. That's why it's almost perfect.
Right, right.
So very few directors had that technique down, especially to the effect that Stanley Kubrick did. So that's one of the big, massive circumstantial pieces of evidence that's used, is that he did this so well. And a lot of people didn't know that yet in the 1960s.
And actually, that's a good point, Jason, because when you look at the movies I was just pointing out, the appearance of it is a bit more fuzzy. It looks, I mean, if you concentrate on it, it just doesn't look as sharp as the rest of the picture. And then when you do get up to the front screen, it looks a lot closer. It's harder to pick out. But when they're doing it on the moon footage, I mean, there are very few images when you can't see a horizon line or a set of rocks or something that ends up being the cut line, which would hide the bottom of the screen. All right, man, welcome back to the second hour of Crow 777 Radio Podcast, episode 38. I am with Jason Lindgren, and we are covering the space illusion. And we kind of cut off the first hour talking about Kubrick, front screen projection, and all these types of things. I would urge anyone who wants to take a closer look at the Apollo landing on the moon missions, go to a website called aulis.com, AULIS.com. If you look around a little bit, you will find some stereoscopic work he did on all the imagery that NASA provides. Not only does he identify the image NASA provided by number so that you can look at the original, he gives the formula that he uses to determine the distances of objects and showing that it was shot on a soundstage. In my view, these are not arguable points. This is hard, cold math. It is what it is, and he's providing the image original to everybody, and he's providing the formula. What this means is that any day of any week, people can take this information and replicate his findings. And to me, that is as solid as it gets. But anyhow, Jason, let's jump back in.
Right. And anybody who wants to see all that laid out in detail about the way the whole Kubrick thing ties in, the documentary I was referring to is called Kubrick's Odyssey by Jay Widener. And I absolutely loved it. I've watched it several times just to kind of get as much out of it as I can. But moving on, we have the successes of Apollos 11 and 12. And already by the second moon landing, the public seems to be very bored with the whole thing. They just don't care. They're even complaining that on major network news on the news that, hey, they're interrupting our programs and all that. Like, people just don't give a crap anymore. It's been done and it's over. So in 1970, we see the drama kicked up a huge notch with the disaster that is Apollo 13.
Yeah.
And that kind of let's create something new. Let's get tension going. Let's get all the focus back on this once again. What do you think about the whole Apollo 13 crew?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what they're doing. I mean, it's typical Tavistock playbook. You know, you go one way and then you go to an extreme and then you go back. And that's how they do all these events. But I would point out, I've always wondered, I was alive, but I was pretty young, so I can't remember with a keen eye unless I would to go back and look at the footage. I have always wondered if the idea that the American people were becoming bored was simply a media construct. In other words, if Walter Cronkite came on to the evening news and said, oh, people are complaining about this, that, or the other thing, is there any reality to it, or are they also projecting that portion of the story? But by the time you get to Apollo 13, we have modern touch points in the movie Apollo 13. And at this point, if you see Tom Hanks in a movie that is some portion of supposed history, you're looking at shenanigans. I mean, he's doing it right now with the Sully. He did the Pirates movie, which was more nonsense. And Apollo 13 is no different. But Jason, I think you hit it on the head. They ratchet it up. They get everyone's heartstrings all entangled. Oh, our good American boys are up there and they might not make it home. They get, what was that guy, the comm chief there, you know, failure is not an option. Mm-hmm. That saying actually entered the American lexicon. That's where it came from, is the command at ground control saying failure is not an option. So you can see the construct of it all.
You know, I'm very curious, and I don't know how we'd ever prove any of this stuff, but how many people were in on the fakery and how many people were just there doing their work? All these technicians you see, you know, in main control rooms sitting at computers with headsets on. How many of these people knew what was going on? How many people didn't?
I, I think that's a simple question. You know, 98% of them were there doing a job. They were looking at a computer monitor. They were looking at telemetry data. They were doing all the things they do in the same way that the guys who helped design the rockets were truly trying to design this amazing machinery to do the job they thought it was going to do. I think almost all this stuff is almost always upper echelon. And then, of course, you have some modern average workaday people who may start to catch on. But that in itself is telling too, because there are documented cases of quite a number of highly trained individuals working on the Apollo missions that quit right before the moon launch happened. So in other words, they spent nearly a decade of their life working to put a man on the moon. And right when they're getting ready to do the big deed, they all walk away. And that was covered up. I think it's just more evidence that demonstrates that at the highest echelons, of course, the fraud is known. All the people, the players, they pretty much think they're doing what they should be doing, have no idea. And then, of course, there's always going to be a few who see through the illusion. And these are probably the stories we see where, you know, here's a scientist worked 10 years and then quits, you know, 2 weeks before the moonshot.
Now, I've never looked into this, but I'd be curious to see if there are a lot of unusual deaths cropping up around, especially around the time of Apollo 11.
Yeah, I don't know. The only death I can think of is the whole Gus Grissom thing. You know, they mm-hmm. you know, wove a whole tale around his unhappiness. And to me, it's just more drama. I would say from my point of view, no one died, no one got hurt. Although you've got to realize when you're doing things like this at such a events of a magnitude like this, you really never know for sure what's going on. But to consider taking a rocket, which is almost like shooting a bullet in some ways, maybe not quite as quick, and putting a human being on the front of it. I mean, really think back to where we started in the first hour, where they're going to take a cannon to shoot the spacecraft. Well, can you put a human being in a vehicle like that and shoot it out of a cannon? Can you take a rocket and put a human being? You know, there's all kinds of footage of Russian astronauts at the launch with a camera in the cockpit with them, and it doesn't jive. It looks like they're going out for a Sunday drive, not, you know, sitting in a rocket that's going to go whatever it is, 17,000 feet a second. I don't know what the number is, but it is darn fast. And I would not be surprised to learn that if you actually did the math, a human being couldn't take those kinds of stresses. And actually, I would add, Jason, when I was in the Marine Corps, I knew a couple fighter pilots, and they had told me, you know, just to pull G's in a jet, what it takes. You know, they've got these special suits, they're taught how to breathe, and they have to do these physical exercises when they go into turns that'll generate big G's, and their suit squeezes their legs so the blood doesn't drain out of their head, and they physically tense up their bodies in a certain way and breathe in a certain way so that they don't pass out just from the G-force of a jet. And a jet's G-force is nowhere near what an Atlas or a Saturn rocket would be.
Well, I think that's very telling right there, because I don't know what the G-forces are, you know, being launched from the ground up into what's supposed to be orbit, but it's got to be absolutely astronomical.
Yeah, going to the next one, I'll try to do a quick lookup on the speed of a rocket.
Well, the Apollo program keeps going after Apollo 13. And we get to 1971, and we have a James Bond film that comes out called Diamonds Are Forever. Now, in this movie, and, you know, with the awesome Sean Connery playing James Bond, we have a scene that's very, very blatant, showing a movie set filming a manned moon mission that looks strikingly similar to the Apollo program. It ends with James Bond stealing the moon buggy that's there to for his getaway from the bad guys. And, you know, this is coming out in 1971 while the Apollo program is still a current thing. You know, there are people supposedly doing launches to the moon, and this movie comes out showing fakery. So, very, very interesting.
It's a poke in the eye. I mean, come on. You know, they're in Vegas. They're doing the whole Howard Hughes type guy. I think his name's Willard White. But they're actually calling Willard White living in the White House in Vegas. I mean, they're doing the full spectrum poke in the eye. But, I mean, how can that be anything more? And I forget what the company is. They supposedly have to do with satellites, I think, in the movie. I've forgotten. But why would they even have a reason to have a mock-up? And they even show fake astronauts moving in slow motion in this fake place where James Bond steals the moon buggy. But let me backtrack for a second. I did a quick search. The average an average bullet travels at 2,500 feet per second. Okay, that's around 1,700 miles per hour. It says a rocket travels at 4.9 miles per second. So there it is.
I mean, those numbers are just ludicrous.
Can a person sit on the front of a bullet? Would the G-force allow them to do that? Could you function traveling at that speed? It's almost unconscionable to think that we've bought into this for so long when basically – how do you explain away things like that? So in the search engine, they're telling me 7.9 kilometers per second, which is 4.9 miles per second. And again, a bullet is 2,500 feet per second. I mean, there's no comparison.
Right. And I think that says pretty much the whole thing right there.
I mean, there's no getting away from it. But anyhow, to get back to Diamonds Are Forever, this, in my mind, this is a bit like casting spells on people. So what's the year? Is it 71 or 72 for Diamonds Are Forever?
Yeah,
71. So the Apollo missions are going on while they're showing this. And it just shows how strong the programming is. You know, James Bond goes into a soundstage. There are fake astronauts being filmed, moving in slow motion on a fake moon set. And he steals the lunar buggy and makes a run for it.
I hadn't even realized until I was doing this homework last night that movie had come out while the Apollo missions were still going on. That really cracked me up.
Yeah, it's almost like if you do it in a fiction movie, then anyone who suggests, you know, that fakery is true is ridiculed because it was covered in a fiction movie. I don't know, man. There's some kind of spellcraft there. And it's not the only movie. I mean, they've done it on Rick and Morty. They've done it on any number. And, you know, so many people who follow me have heard me talk about National Geographic. Right before I left San Diego, Geographic put out a magazine with a mock lunar lander on the cover that was clearly fake sitting somewhere, and they mocked all the people who didn't believe in the moon mission. And that tells you something. For them to go through the effort to put out a magazine with that on the cover and then mock the people who are challenging the moon landing, in my view, that is a very telling thing.
Yeah, there's a lot of effort that goes into that. So they felt that story was the most important thing to put out that month in this giant magazine. I mean, come on.
No, and it's got international circulation, one of the last magazines that does. But anyhow, there it is.
Right. So that's 1971. We have Diamonds Are Forever. We have Apollos 14 through 17, which are also supposed to be huge successes. And then the program is terminated in 1972. No more moon. Then we get to 1973. Which is the year of Skylab, with the first big space station for NASA. And that is supposed to be in space from 73 to 79, when it's purported to have fallen from its orbit and burned up in the atmosphere. Any thoughts on Skylab?
Yeah, I actually did some work on this, and I don't have the numbers exact in my mind, but anyone can go back through my YouTube videos. Here's the thing. One of the reasons we're told that the moon missions terminated was partly because Americans were bored, but more so because of the cost. Okay. And I did an actual verbatim outline of what the actual cost of the moon missions was as we went into Skylab. Skylab was supposed to keep us in space and reduce all the costs. Well, the truth of it is that by the time the space shuttles came around and Skylab was around, they were spending many times what the supposed moon mission cost. And again, I have a clip up somewhere that gives the numbers on these. But here's the thing. Skylab was supposed to be a way for us to more cheaply be in space and do all these amazing science things. Can anyone listening to me right now think of one amazing piece of science that came away from Skylab? And I'm guessing the answer to that was probably no.
They sold lots of Tang.
I would imagine that was the main success there.
Well, so in 1975, we have the last use of the Apollo equipment, supposedly. Apollo 18, the command module docks with the Soviet Soyuz 19. This is supposed to be the last claimed U.S. space flight, manned space flight, until the shuttle launches begin in 81. Now, throughout the rest of the 1970s, we have tons of images being released of Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, a lot of which are coming from the two Voyager spacecrafts. Now, I'm sure you've probably torn these to shreds, but let's go ahead and talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, anyone can go look at not just work done by me, but by tons of people that have demonstrated that the images are nothing more than artist renderings. They're constructs of one kind or another. And quite often, when you look at the images, the description below the image that everyone ignores will quite often tell you that it's a construct. See, the problem here is that when people see these images, they get the sense that it's a snapshot from a camera. And to be perfectly clear, there is no existing image that we are aware of Earth from space that is a snapshot from a camera. There is no existing snapshot of any planet or any space body that we are aware of. They are all claimed to be telemetry, artist rendering, mosaics, all these other words for an artist rendering. And again, if people go look at my recent work on the Rosetta Comet landing, the fraud is so overwhelmingly in your face. Anyone who thinks about it will come to the realization that what we're looking at is full spectrum programming designed to put an image of what planets and space look like in your mind, but there is no basis in reality.
Right. And we already briefly discussed the impact that the television show Star Trek had in the 60s. We come to 1977 with the first space shuttle that is named Enterprise. And the majority of the cast of Star Trek was actually there for its public debut. This is a major public melding of the entertainment industry with what's supposed to be reality. You know, this is really we start seeing these things being completely put together and shoved in our faces. Now, the Enterprise never flew, but...
You know, Jason, I've said this. It's like one of the rules I live by. Serious endeavors do not cross over into the sphere of entertainment. They just don't. If you are doing a serious-minded thing, it has no relationship or place being anywhere near entertainment. And not only that, when I was at the Houston kind of Space Disneyland Center, one of the first little crafts was named Galileo. And it wasn't because of Galileo. I hope I'm getting these names right. It was because Star Trek had first had a shuttle named Galileo. So they were admitting to you right there and then that it's not because we had a great man named Galileo. It's because a TV show named Star Trek showed this on the small screen. This is a telling thing. This is a fingerprint that should never be dismissed. When you see a close proximity between NASA and Hollywood, you have to understand what you are looking at.
Now, the Enterprise never flew in space, supposedly. It was made just as an atmospheric test unit. But still, there was the name Enterprise shoved right in your face.
Which is also the name of a sailing ship, mm-hmm. and actually a perfect allegory, because the Enterprise that was on TV never went to space either. So it's a perfect naming.
And, you know, the term Enterprise is also in business, and a lot of people tie this into the whole Maritime Admiralty Law just once again being flaunted in front of us.
Of course. Of course.
Now we get to 1978 with the release of a little movie called Capricorn One, which I had never actually seen, and I watched it the other day. It was kind of boring, to be honest with you, but the plot is that the first manned mission to Mars, they didn't really say what year this was supposed to be, but I'm assuming it was taking place in the late 70s, just like its actual release. The equipment looks almost identical to the Apollo equipment, other than just saying whatever the name of the spacecraft was, Capricorn 1. The mission is faked to keep funding going to the program, but there was a technical error that would have killed the crew en route. So the head scientist, director, whatever he was supposed to be, came up with this plan to fake the whole thing. He had to convince the astronauts of it and keep the money flowing, basically. So, of course, the astronauts pitch a fit about this and have to be coerced and threatened to carry out this whole thing. And they realize that their lives might be in danger. And the plot of the movie is the command module, or whatever it was, burned up by accident in the atmosphere, and it was publicly released about that. So all of a sudden, these guys are supposed to be dead. So in the movie, they break out of the room that they've been chilling out in and go on the run, and the government officials actually hunt them down and try and kill them, and only one of them makes it. So,
yeah, you know,
interesting concept.
I haven't seen it for a long time, but I remember thinking at the time that it was really an allegory for the moon missions. The period of the movie that it was supposed to be taking place was right. And there was a lot of encoding, even the name of the movie, Capricorn. Well, Capricorn is the winter solstice constellation. And of course, that relates so heavily to the whole, you know, Crowley-esque idea and the allegory that's used in religion so often of fire and ice, when hell is in fact when the sun is at its lowest, weakest point. But to take that a step further, here again we have a fiction-based movie challenging what NASA can do and pointing out that there are lies being done, but it's done in a fiction-based way. And I don't know exactly how that works, but it seems like in a way it offsets people's almost like a release valve. You know, people see this and then that prevents them from ever wanting to look more closely at the things they've been lied to about. I'm just not sure, but I don't think there's any doubt. It's a one-to-one allegory for the moon and all the nonsense that went on there, even to the point where the technical glitch that they couldn't get them there because of something in the environment. Well, that's where we live in spades, in my view. Nobody goes above low Earth orbit because you can't.
Well, it had to be a direct allegory, because even if we go with the notion that the planetary bodies and space are the way they're portraying it, the same equipment used for Apollo would not get you to Mars. It's just, and it looks identical to it. It's like, I'm sorry, that's not how it would work. It's a zillion times farther.
If you want to go down that road, all the new SpaceX stuff is just the Apollo mission junk with a new paint job, basically. We saw it at the Houston thing. There's the old Apollo moon equipment, and then here's the new stuff called Orion, and then the SpaceX stuff, and it looks damn near identical. There's none of this flashy kind of cool spaceship looking thing. It's just more little capsules and modules that have been painted a little more nicely. The technology doesn't look to have advanced nearly as much as it should have.
Right, and I do believe that SpaceX is being done off of the launch pad from Apollo 11, if I remember correctly.
I'm not sure about that. I guess I'd have to look into that.
I thought I remember reading that when I was looking up SpaceX a few months ago.
Could be.
The other thing is that the current purported mission to Mars and other use for this program is called Orion. And It looks very similar to the Apollo command module. It's just a little bigger, but when
looked
at all the pictures and everything like that, it really just doesn't look any different. It's a slightly bigger Apollo capsule. Now, the argument could be that that's just the practical way it would work, but eh.
I mean, come on. Shouldn't we have some pretty sleek kind of badass craft at this point if that's really what was going on? And shouldn't we really be actually doing what's supposedly Virgin Galactic? That's another thing. So here is SpaceX trying to get Apollo or NASA out of the picture. In my view, that's why they're there. Because once they get rid of NASA and SpaceX is a private corporation, no one can say boo to a private corporation. Not that we really could to NASA, but supposedly there would be recourse if someone came along and took them to task for all the lies they've told. So as the private corporation SpaceX replaces NASA, we still have Virgin Galactic in the wings. Well, for what, 15 years or more now, with all these ex-NASA people, they haven't been able to take a reusable craft to the edge of space, let it fall to Earth and reuse it in a day or so, or whatever their criteria is. It shows the fraud. Really, in the 60s, we had no experience. We went to the moon. We brought people back. And all this technology and ability and funding later, Virgin Galactic has built this huge spaceport and hasn't even come close to flying to the edge of space with a reusable vehicle. I think anything that is looked at with scrutiny here demonstrates that we're looking at stagecraft A to Z, and I don't think SpaceX is part of that same game.
Now, even if these private companies were trying to do something legit, what I want to know is, where is the money coming from? You know, a company exists to make profits.
Exactly. I mean, and look, you've got Sir Richard Branson, so I guess he's working for the Queen, right? He's knighted. That means something. Maybe he's buddies with Jimmy Page and they drink with the Queen on Wednesdays. I don't know what exactly that means. My point is this. You're looking at a very rich man who supposedly owns Virgin Airlines, Virgin, all this other stuff, and yet for 15 years now, they haven't turned a dime in profit, and yet it's still a going concern. And actually, the last quote I heard from Sir Richard Branson when he was asked, well, what's going on here, guys? You've been at this 15 years. You're no closer. He looked at the camera and said, "Turns out space is hard."
You think?
Well, yeah, I don't know. Let's go back to 1961 with the JFK speech. You know, we do these things not because they are easy, but because they are hard. You know, it's a whole other tone going on there. Well, yeah, it might be difficult, but we're going to try to do this lie. Where you get up to Richard Branson, it's just like, well, we've really been trying, guys, but did you know how hard it is?
It just, I've never been able to figure that out. Now, I should probably do more digging and see what else these companies are doing that maybe they're making profits from. But I just have trouble believing that they've got the billions and billions of dollars that a real space program would need just floating around, that they could just keep throwing it away year after year. Now, maybe a major oil company or maybe something the size of Apple or Microsoft would have those kinds of billions. But I just have trouble believing that a normal corporation would just be able to do these things.
No, see, Virgin Galactic exists for one reason and one reason only: to further the illusion in the minds of the world that space has been, is what you have been told it is, and that somehow average private companies and pretty soon normal people can participate in space. And I'm here to tell you, I will eat crow on mic if they ever truly go to space, ever truly go to Mars, ever truly do these things in any convincing way, because there is just endless mountains of evidence. And this sets aside all the work I did with the telescope. You know, I know what is up there. I filmed for 4 years straight. There's these little black round things. They could even be balloons. Who knows? That is what is up there. If there were something like 15 to 30,000 satellites, a mathematician recently calculated we should see hundreds of them transit the moon every hour or three. Don't remember the numbers. My point being, I have sat looking at the moon for weeks on end. Film maybe one thing, maybe two things. Other times I get lucky, film three in a night. Point is, when you spend months filming and you just get those few seconds of film, you begin to get a picture of what is truly going on up there. And there are no satellites up there. There has never been a single thing that I have filmed that looks like a satellite should look. And that sets aside that now we're being told so many of the satellites are what they call micro satellites. So it's like a 1 foot cube or something. The more you look at the details, the more you come to understand that we're in a closed environment and nobody goes above roughly 60 to 100 miles, whatever that might be.
Right. I believe the highest weather balloons get to that has been accurately recorded by numerous people independently is 121,000.
Feet,
yeah.
I'd have to do the conversion. I don't know what that is in miles.
Right.
My point is this. We are in an age where if we were truly in space all the time, we would be getting such astounding imagery. And this is not what happens. Even on like flybys of Juno or these other things they claim they're doing, what we get at first every time is these crappy images. In the modern age, oh, well, there's crappy images. And so people try to defend this by saying, well, they got to send it through space. Well, so what? Would you rather spend less time sending a crappy image through space or more time sending an excellent picture through space? Time is not a factor in this. The factor is, does it matter what the quality of your images are? And the same time they approach any of these missions, and there's going to be a bunch of them this year, I just read about them in Sky and Telescope, you see these so-so images, they tend to get a little better, and then it kind of cuts off, and then the magazines like Sky and Telescope come out, and by then the artists have had their way with the images, and they start to look all spectacular. But even the last time they did this, the images looked like they were pulled straight out of a 3D program for making, you know, 3D globes and images. People just really need to kind of concentrate on what they're being shown. And again, there's a lot of people out there showing that half the images you've ever seen of Jupiter are oil paintings.
Huh, they look it, actually.
Yeah, they do.
Here's the big thing. In my hand right now as I'm speaking to you, I'm holding my brand new iPhone 7 I got 2 weeks ago. In this phone is a 4K camera. This thing, and I took pictures of my daughter ice skating, things like that. The pictures are stellar. I mean, they are super crisp. It's absolutely amazing what this little device can do.
Of course.
So, if I can get this object for a reasonable price on the mainstream market, I can walk into any AT&T store, which is what I did, and buy this thing. What the hell is going on with companies with billions and billions of dollars or governmental organizations that – they can't get a decent camera into space. And even 10 years ago, camera technology was still really good. Digital camera technology I'm referring to here.
Well, I did the Rosetta mission clip where they had stated that they made the camera. So out of all their funding, they made the camera they wanted from scratch. I think it was 4 megapixels. And the funny thing was, is here you're going to go for 10 years to supposedly go land on this comet, which incidentally was discovered in the 60s on 9/11, of course. But in the 90s, Kodak had already had a professional camera with 6 megapixels. So all those years later, here's the European Space Agency making a 4-megapixel camera. And when I made this an issue, they tried to shame me. They picked me up in the Daily Mail in the UK. They picked me up in Gizmodo. And all these people out of the gamer community came to thumbs down and troll my video because I had had the audacity to point out how ridiculous the very thing you just said is. It proves something. If you're going to go to a place for the first time, the quality of your images is everything. And yet that's never the case when these space agencies go out.
Yeah, it's just absolutely ludicrous because even 10 years ago, let's forget everything from the past. 10 years ago, pretty large megapixel cameras existed. You know more about camera technology than I do, but a pretty damned good Canon or Nikon even 10 years ago was what, 12 megapixels maybe?
Yeah, I think it was the late 90s. Kodak's best, I think, if I'm remembering correctly, was 6 megapixels. But that's a long, long time ago. I mean, like you're saying now, you're holding 4K in your hand. There's really no excuse for it. And the reason there's no excuse is because the space agencies often claim they are making the cameras, which in my mind means if they wanted to make 100 million megapixels, they could. What stops them? The only thing that stops somebody from making something better is that a consumer has to be able to afford it. You know, and right now the big battle in the DSLRs is to get to 50 megapixels. Well, it's not that they can't make 50 megapixels. It's that they have to make a product people can afford to buy so that the company can turn a profit. This is not the goal of a space agency. The goal of the space agency is to go collect data, supposedly, which should mean the best damn images money can buy. Otherwise, why send the supposed spacecraft 10 years through space? Which, of course, is not happening, but it does show the fraud, the quality of the images that are constantly handed off. I did a similar thing when I took my 8-inch telescope and shot Jupiter and its moons and compared it to images NASA was pawning off on us. And again, so many people came by to try to shame me, but I'm sorry. If I can take a picture of the moons of Jupiter from my backyard and have them be sharp and crisp, there's no way in hell you're ever going to convince me that a spacecraft in the vacuum of space is not taking infinitely better images of objects that are a similar size. And that's not what we see.
No, not at all. Now, 2 points to bring up here. The reason why I was saying 10 years ago, let's say we'll forget everything of the past. We'll just let all that go. 10 years ago, let's say we have a 12-megapixel digital camera, and we launch a probe with that 12-megapixel camera towards a planet. What kind of images would that be able to deliver back now, 10 years later, getting to its destination? I would say far better than anything we've seen so far. Point number two. On the Lunar Wave Roundtable that you and I and Randy from Houston did, and the other gentleman, the new one that you had come upon,
yeah.
Now we can't prove, obviously, what exactly the new fellow had done because none of us knew him, but he said that he had filmed that with an old cell phone camera that he had, and that's all he used. And we all looked at that footage, and all that was a cell phone strapped to a telescope, and it looked really good. So
yeah, exactly. Oh, okay, I've caught up with you. Yeah, exactly right. I remember now. I've forgotten his name. That's terrible. But that's exactly what he was doing. Just taking a modern cell phone and getting some pretty darn good imagery.
And it wasn't even a modern cell phone. I remember him saying that this was an older one that didn't work anymore, but the camera still worked. So he had strapped it to a telescope and then was transmitting the data back to his computer. And that's an older camera, you know, let alone the object sitting right next to me right now.
This is imagery is one of the reasons I first started to catch on to the fraud in the 90s. And here's why. In the 90s, we didn't have digital cameras when I first got my first robotic 8-inch scope. I had to use film. What that meant was when you're taking images with film, you're opening up the shutter and you have to track the telescope perfectly so that the stars don't streak or the planet or whatever you're shooting doesn't streak. Now, the longer you hold open the shutter, the more light you collect and the better image of the object you'll get. What I was trying to do was replicate as closely as I could the Hubble Space Telescope images. And it was then that I realized that you're just looking at artist renderings. I can look at M42, the Orion Nebula. I can open up a shutter and take a picture that does show me the rough shape of the nebula I would expect to see. But with the cameras I had access to, they would always be red. Then I heard, oh, if you use Fujifilm, you'll get some greens, which was true. So you get maybe a hint of green and some reds. So now I'm thinking, okay, what if I did color channels? And I started to go down that avenue. And I began to realize there's no way in hell I can ever begin to replicate what the Hubble Space Telescope is doing. So I started looking into the images. That's when I began to understand that they're all false color. In some of them, it's claimed they're invisible spectrums that they've turned into visible color. They're all constructs. There are no snapshots. And yet with my telescope in my backyard, I was opening a shutter on a SLR camera, because it wasn't digital yet, and letting light collect on a piece of film that is an actual picture of reality, or at least what I can see, whatever that might be. The Hubble Space Telescope stuff is nonsense. And now I've talked to people recently that will begin to even tell you there is there is nothing in space, to cut to the chase here. There is no Hubble Space Telescope. And there has also been YouTube channels that show that a really good telescope, a ground-based, can replicate those images that Hubble was purveying. And they showed how to do it with modern tools like Photoshop and other things. So, I mean, there it is. And that's what clued me in, was the images that I could not even come close to replicating.
Now, I don't know if you know the answer to this, but I'm very curious. A high-flying jet would obviously have a lot less atmosphere from coming to it from, as opposed to shooting from the ground. So if you stuck a good camera out the window of a high-flying jet, how different would you get image-wise compared to a ground-based?
If it was high-tech and it tracked perfectly, it would be night and day, because the air gets thinner, so you've got less atmosphere, less air, clouds, all of it. Not only that, the temperature is going to be a lot lower, so you don't have, temperature differentiation, which is what makes a lot of the bad seeing when warm air and cool air are mixing, or when warm air is leaving the face of the ground and going up into the cool night air. That's what gives you those shimmery images when I'm using my telescope. You get up in a plane like Sophia, and I had a guy on that talked about this, and he demonstrated to my satisfaction that every Hubble image you've ever seen was shot from the Sophia airplane, and there were a number of instruments on there. But to cut to the chase, yeah, you would have no heat problem. You would have no cloud problem. You would have no air density problems, because the air gets thinner the higher you go.
Right. That's exactly what I think as well. I mean, I have a pretty good understanding of basic physics, so...
People look into the Sophia aircraft and look at the instruments are on there. I've forgotten the episode verbatim, but even it's said that identical equipment from the Hubble Space Telescope, I think, and the Sophia were there. But there was something a little bit better on the Sophia than even the Hubble Space Telescope had. But, you can go back and listen to that episode. I think it was with Robert Bassano. I kind of fell out with him. I cut contact with him shortly after. But nonetheless, the episode is up.
Is that the same gentleman? There's a video that I watched a few months ago. He had contacted whatever agency had direct relations with the Hubble Space Telescope program.
That's why I ended up talking to him. It was a clip called Grad Student, Does Something. I've forgotten what it's called, but that was why I ended up talking with him.
Okay, yeah, because I've heard that.
Yeah, there's some persuasive arguments made. He even goes into, I've told you, what you will see is these round black objects if you film the moon long enough on very straight trajectories. And he covers the fact that there are no satellites and that it's likely these balloons that just stay up there all the time are doing many of the things we would expect a satellite to do. There it is.
All right. Well, going back to our timeline, we're into the 1980s now, and we see the successes of the space shuttle program. Until 1986, when the Challenger blows up shortly after liftoff, that suspends any supposed shuttle flights until 1988. Now, a few years ago, two or three at the most, someone started doing research demonstrating that they found all but one of the crew members to supposedly still be alive and well.
And actually, one of them hadn't even changed his name, I think.
Yeah, several of them claim to be twins of the original crew members, which is just kind of silly to begin with. And some are indeed even using the same name. Now, not to go into a huge thing about this, but the whole straw man identity and your corporate name and all that, that's a very real thing. We are corporate identities in the system. And the easy way to prove that to yourself is by using the Social Security Death Index. If, when you die, it is recorded and that number is recycled, because everyone who is interacting with the matrix system we live in has to be part of this. And I proved it to myself. I looked up my my grandfather, who passed away almost two decades ago now, and I found him. And supposedly, these people are not in there.
I didn't know that. There's another nail in the coffin, isn't there?
Right. So if these people did indeed sadly die in an explosion in 1986, why are they not registered on the Social Security Death Index? Because every American has a Social Security number, do they not?
Yeah, well, there it is. And, you know, we're kind of getting into an area. So many people, when they're told someone dies, they get fearful that, okay, now this is off limits. We can't challenge it because we might hurt someone's feelings. And what I would point out, we have demonstrated enough things about this system that it doesn't make a difference anymore. You either man up or woman up, and you take a stance and you challenge something. If you find you're wrong, there is no shame in saying, I'm sorry I was wrong, I retract. But I would suggest that in things like the space shuttle disaster, you're not wrong. There is so much evidence. What Jason just told you is the most damning piece of evidence. I mean, I've seen all the work done that shows these people didn't die. There's only one person they can't find, and then all of them claiming they were twins. I mean, come on. Really? What are the odds even? But then to find that they never went on the death index, that's a very telling thing. And these are people who are teaching at universities. I mean, do you remember some of the jobs these people are holding, Jason? I know one man, I think it's the guy.
Yeah, they're doing major positions. They're like professors at universities. One worked for a major corporation, was like a CEO. Like, they're not working at McDonald's. They're doing big stuff.
So there it is. The people teaching the young generation who are participating in the fraud of space, what do you think they're teaching the kids? Do you think they're teaching the kids that they should question everything? Or do you think they're teaching the kids that damn well Neil Armstrong stood on the moon? Damn well the Columbia blew up and people died. You know what they're teaching, because they are complicit in the fraud. And it's been pretty much proven. I mean, I don't think this kind of thing would even stand up in a court of law when you get to the extreme that Jason's talking about.
Right. Now, I haven't double-checked the facts on that, but I intend to do so when I have a little bit of time. I'm gonna find that out. I'm going to get these people's names, I'm going to get all their information, and I'm going to go through the Social Security Death Index, and I'm going to prove that to myself so that I can say, hey, if you want to take my word for it, I did the homework. Here it is. They're not in there. I want to know for certain. I'm taking some other researcher's word for it right now, but if it turns out to be 100% accurate, that is probably one of the most damning pieces of evidence we could put out. Without these people walking up and saying, hey, by the way, I'm so-and-so.
Well, point taken. Not only that, Jason, that begins to translate over into all the false flag attacks. Let's go look at all the Sandy Hook deaths, you know, because kids are issued a Social Security number at birth these days. When I was a kid, you didn't get your Social Security number until your first job. I think I was 13 or something, 12, when I went to go get my Social Security number, because I had to, because I was going to be employed. But these days, the day you're born, the straw man identity is set up, which means the birth certificate and the Social Security number. So my point would be is we understand that you took it secondhand and that you'll confirm it. But if you can confirm this, that's another very damning piece of evidence when you go to look at any of these false events. And it would be another layer of trouble the hoaxsters would have to go through to try to get people on the death register when they're faking the deaths.
Right. And this is where we can actually use the system against them. You know, this whole thing is set up and this web is heavily weaved. So why not use that as a weapon in our arsenal?
Right. I mean, it's no different than some of the earliest researchers I was watching found a tool online that shows internet traffic to just about any facility that has an internet connection over so many years. And I forget how many years it had been, but they showed that the Sandy Hook school in Newtown, Connecticut had not had an internet connection for, I forget, was it 2 or 3 years? I don't remember, but they proved there's a school that had no internet connection for years before this event. It's evidence like this that is not really an arguable thing. If you've got a school, well, guess what? We're in the modern age. You're going to need an internet connection. And yet we can show that it didn't have these things, which is no different than you demonstrating if someone dies, they have to show up on the Social Security death register. If they're not there, then not even the country recognizes that they're dead.
Exactly. And that's what I say to everybody. Go do your own homework. This is what I've been doing. I wanted to know about this stuff, so what did I do? I started watching the official releases of the film footage from the NASA missions. You know,
yeah.
I saw the Challenger thing. I'm going to look it up. I'm going to do my own research, and I'm going to prove to myself and try my best to pass that on to you since I also do a show. Hey, this is what I found. Go look this up and prove it to yourself and tell someone else.
Jason, there's a hell of a show in this. I mean, if you get back to me if you think this has legs and that there's a there and that it's real, there's a hell of a show, because not can you just demonstrate that the Columbia shuttle was nonsense, which we already know it was. People don't go up in rockets. Rockets are going faster than bullets, and people can't travel at that speed in just some stupid little spacesuit. My point would be that technique that you're uncovering here could be applied to any number of false events, and it would be a very difficult thing to cover up because they have claimed the death of so many people in these false events.
That's right. So I just gave everyone listening to this a huge weapon to use against this constructed matrix we're trapped in.
Yeah, and I mean, doesn't that lead to other things? I mean, the average person who got interested in this and started to demonstrate that the supposed deceased person is not on the Social Security death register for that number to be recycled, that's going to open avenues into all these other types of paperwork that happened on the death of a person. I mean, it doesn't even start to address, you know, when someone dies, they go to a mortuary, you know, they're cremated. There's all this paperwork. When my father died, think of the credit card crap we had to go through and just all of it. And that doesn't even start to touch the tax IDs and all the things that have to be, you're supposed to report that this person no longer exists. So I think what you just dropped there, Jason, is maybe the most promising tool for the average person I've heard in a long time.
Right. And since you have a big forum with all this, you know, maybe other people who have done more research than I have and into this whole thing can offer suggestions and assistance. You know, it's like, hey, this is the easiest way to prove this.
Maybe what we'll do is if we find out this is real and it's not just somebody making claims that can't be substantiated, at some point we'll do a show where we just do it live. We'll just use the method and we'll just start grabbing random false events and checking people and just do it live. You know, just record on the fly with no planning, no nothing. And, you know, check all the supposed shuttle accidents, check Sandy Hook, check the Boston bombing, check anywhere where all these deaths are claimed in events that we now call hoaxes.
Apollo 1.
Yeah, there you go. Gus Grissom. Is Gus Grissom on the register? That was a long time ago.
Well, for the time period, because it'll be recorded when?
I'm not sure. I mean, we have to confirm it's real, but I mean, all these questions I'm already building in my mind. But it'll be interesting. If you find out there's a there, we'll definitely see if we can do something with it.
Well, I'm definitely going to work on that. So we'll pick that up when I have more to go on.
Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of thing that is so handy because any person could pick that up and look into a thing. You know, like these hoax bus crashes they've been doing. I just did that show with the guy Changing Reason, who has a relatively new YouTube channel. You know, and it turns out, here's the ironic thing. It turns out that I had made this really kind of bad video. Croette and I sang a song, Nobody Died, Nobody Got Hurt. I was intentionally using repetition because that's what they use against us when they're programming us. So I just sang through this whole video, Nobody Died, Nobody Got Hurt. He heard that and he, for the first time, said, what are they talking about? And started to investigate. Now he's got his own channel. And so, I mean, even these bus crashes he's been covering, are those kids on the death register now? Remains to be seen. You know, that's the ultimate arbitration right there. When the state is telling you this violence happened, these lives were taken, and yet their own recording system does not reflect that. To me, that's the ultimate arbitration.
It is. And I think I've told you this before, but I'll reiterate it now. The reason why I know really any kind of reality to this whole straw man thing is 15 years ago, I'm watching Jordan Maxwell videos and he's talking about all this stuff. And I was like, okay, so we're traded on the stock market. Well, it was easier to look things up back then
right.
than it is now.
Yep.
But I went and I followed just looked on forums and people talking about this, and I went and looked up on Fidelity.com how this is done, and I found my stock. It was linked to my Social Security card.
Right.
So that proved to me, at least to some degree, that what these people are talking about, like, I know Jordan Maxwell is the one who's been doing it the longest that I'm aware of, and I've been watching his stuff for like 15 years, and I think I may have done that around 2007 because I was slowly learning about it over the few years, and then I said, screw this, I'm going to prove this to myself. I'm going to see if this has, if this really holds any water. And you know what? It sure does.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't just hold water. It's a bit of a window into the matrix. You know, the channel that I mentioned a few times here, Rob S., last name ESS, Rob S. on YouTube. He's in Scotland, and he's challenging the legal system because he has outed the straw man. He has outed the illegal use of a legal person and legal fictions and just the whole gamut. And he's challenging it all, and he's standing alone doing this. This is part and parcel about what Jason is talking about. And if the death register for Social Security numbers becomes a true thing that Jason can confirm, it's part and parcel of the same admiralty law system, which turns us all into corporations. And that is why this is such a powerful thing, Jason, because in this system, we're all strawman corporate entities, which means when a corporation ends, there has to be a record of that corporation ending. And that record is your Social Security number, right? That's your corporate ID.
That's it. Yep. And we are used as collateral.
Yeah, chattel.
Mm-hmm. And traded on the world markets. Like, this is, they make money off of our existence is basically what it comes down to.
That's right. Now, someone had just sent me, I know we're getting a little off the space thing, we'll get back in a minute, but someone had just sent me a thing about a lady who was demonstrating what you could do with your birth certificate. And I didn't have a chance to get all the way through it, but it looked like she was saying, from the little bit that I was able to get through so far, that you could erase debt with your birth certificate. So if anyone is aware of what I'm talking about, maybe they can send me a new link to that. I did get it on the Crow 777 radio podcast email. But anyhow, Jason, let's jump back into the list and go a little further through. We've kind of taken a non-forceful approach to trying to demonstrate the fraud of space, but part of the problem in doing that is it puts the onus on the listener to go out and prove things to themselves. So let's try to get through a little bit more of this before we call it an episode.
Sure. And what the things we were just discussing, just they kind of go hand in hand with this, that it's all a fraud. Everything about our existence is a fraud.
That's right.
But so we get to the 80s and 90s. Tons of images have been released at this point from multiple probes that are supposedly out there. 1990, as we were discussing before, is supposed to be when the Hubble Space Telescope was put into space. And, of course, it's releasing these what look to be very spectacular images of our universe, and they're beautiful and just absolutely mind-numbing. We get up to 1996, and we see the first mainstream claim of life at least previously existing on the planet Mars in microbial form. And this is based off of the study of a meteorite that was recovered from Antarctica in 1984,
of course, yeah.
So this is why I wrote all these dates down. I want to make sure I get these points driven home. You know, like as I was doing this homework last night and putting all this list together so that I can have these facts straight, you're seeing all these points line up, you know?
Right. Well, with the Mars stuff that you're referencing, and then there was the whole stupid thing about the blueberries, these little blue balls. And that was kind of an insidious thing, and it had got me thinking. I think almost 2 years ago, I took Mars imagery after I had watched a Big Bang episode where the Jewish astronaut Wolowitz made the offhand comment. Someone said, "Where is the rover?" And he said, "It's down a dirt road in Bakersfield somewhere," because he was driving the lunar rover. In the episode, I went back and I grabbed a bunch of images, and what I quickly find out is that those are just images of a desert, and the color channel has been shifted in probably something as banal as Photoshop, because I can put a Mars image in Photoshop and do a color shift back to where the sky is blue, and it looks like any desert shot you've ever seen. And this is why I'm mentioning this, is because they had taken, let me back up a little. Early on, we were told that the sky was red in Mars. And then somehow pictures came to light that were supposed to be of Mars with a blue sky, at which point we were told that sunrise works the exact opposite on Mars, that the sky was blue at sunrise, on Mars for some reason. Then later on, it became sometimes the sky is blue, and now most of the images you see, the sky doesn't look that red. Well, when they started getting to all the images that I broke apart and proved that it was just color channel manipulation, they started sticking blueberries, these little blue rocks they call blueberries. And the thing about that was, it was funny because if you shift the color channel with any color but red in it, of course it looks wrong. But what was really the final kind of proof to me that all those images were faked was they had pictures of the rover, and things on the rover were a certain color on Earth, and then there were pictures of them supposedly on Mars, and that was proof beyond doubt that they had shifted the color palette, because what used to be white or yellow or blue or a flag had been shifted in the color channels. So it's proof positive. You've never seen a picture of Mars because there is no Mars in the way it's been described to you.
Now, the pictures we see nowadays, just to kind of back all that up, are very, very different, strikingly so, from the images of the Viking pictures from the 70s that that a well-known figure in the conspiracy movement, Richard C. Hoagland, jumped up and down for a zillion years about, saying, hey, there's a face on Mars. And that's what he was using, was the Viking images.
Yeah, ironic that a man who worked for NASA would end up being the guy playing that game, trying to convince us all that aliens were on the moon and aliens were on Mars. What you're looking at in Hoagland is a man, and by the way, he called me a CIA operative in a Newsweek interview. I'd never spoken with him, and he actually said it was obvious that Crow was a CIA operative, and which is so ironic because he was literally a NASA employee during the moon landings. But to fast forward through that, what men like him are doing is implanting further, more deeply, the image of a Mars like you would expect to see it in your mind, more deeply an image of the moon, and even suggesting that aliens have been to either one of these two places creates the illusion in your mind that there is this planet, this body that someone could walk on. We don't have any evidence that shows you could walk on the moon. As a matter of fact, I say over and over, I don't think you can. I think it emanates its own light, and I think that what we know about what we see is that they are lights, and people have problems with that description. But Hoagland and people like him, who are NASA employees, come along and they just start pummeling the alien idea and the we can land on these planets like NASA said we could. So on the one hand, they're claiming NASA lied, but everything else they told you was true. So
right
there it is.
So we get up to 1998, which is supposed to be when the ISS is supposed to begin construction. Then we get up to 2003, and the Space Shuttle Columbia breaks up on reentry into the Earth's atmosphere. And then there's supposedly no more shuttle launches until 2005. Now, throughout all the 2000s is when we have an insane amount of images of very questionable nature being released from the Hubble Space Telescope. Tons. This is when the internet's in full bloom and people are just looking at all these images and there's websites set up and all that. So whatever it is they're doing, they've got it into a massive full swing by this point.
Right. And you got to remember, and Bush, I think it was during Bush the Jr.'s presidency, they were going to no longer service the Hubble Space Telescope because it was too dangerous. And there was like this worldwide outcry from all the, universities. What are you talking about? This is the most important instrument we have. You know what's ironic about this? We are told that every second of Hubble Space Telescope time is booked. See, the way it works on Earth is if you wanted to book time on a terrestrial telescope, you get this time slot. If your time slot comes up and the weather is bad, and a lot of them, too bad, you missed your chance because someone is booked for the next day. The Hubble Space Telescope is no different, except that it doesn't have the weather problem. There's never going to be a day it can't shoot. But every minute is thing. But the thing is nobody knows where the data is coming from. They sit down at their computer and all this data streams in, and they're told this is what the Hubble Space Telescope gave you. Is there an easier way to fake an instrument than what I have just described? And again, Bush was trying to say, oh, we're going to get rid of this, and all the universities went crazy. And meanwhile, as Jason mentioned, all this kind of suspicious imagery is flowing out of the place for like, what, an 8-year period or something like that?
Yeah, just image after image after image. So.
Right.
Well, we get up to 2006, and there's a NASA spacecraft called Stardust that supposedly returns safely to Earth after being the first craft to capture dust from a comet. And I remember those images, and once again, talking about our whole megapixel cameras, they looked like crap. The images they put out, I mean, it just looked like it was a joke.
I'll tell you why, because comets don't exist as described. The first comet that I really concentrated on was called Hale-Bopp. It coincided, I had bought my first fully robotic 8-inch telescope sometime, some months before Hale-Bopp became visible. And I knew it was coming. I remember the announcement. Some dude named Hale spotted it on the same night, a guy named Bopp. So it got the name Hale-Bopp. You're expecting, because you've seen all these images, these space images of what a comet should look like. And so I remember going out into East County with my telescope at a friend's house that I used to work as a stagehand for. And I set up and I looked at it and I was so disappointed. Through the telescope, it was this just kind of blurry smudge. Then I was learning more about what the astronomy community said. And they told you the best view of a comet is with your naked eyes or weak binoculars. Well, they were right. But even through weak binoculars, it's this disappointing kind of smear in the sky. And it's not moving, by the way. No movement other than the rotation of the sky. I remember thinking about that for a long time until we got up to the Rosetta missions and I began to demonstrate, you know, the fingerprint was on Rosetta. It was discovered on 9/11 in 1960 something, and they arrived at Rosetta so that if the calendar was carefully crafted, it would have arrived on 9/11. I think it was 9/10 or something like that. So what I'm here to tell you is comets do not exist as described either. And there is basically nothing in space that exists as described. Now, does this mean that we couldn't learn something new? Of course we could. What I'm telling you is that the evidence we've been handed does not hold up. So just to kind of put a fine point on it, I guess.
The late 2000s, we're back to Mars in a very big way. We have multiple probes there sending back tons of data, supposedly, about the nature of the red planet. And this is where we start seeing the differences in the imagery compared to the old 70s Viking images. So
right,
and the face on Mars thing is dismissed at this point. They say, see, it's just a mountain.
Well, the images they're giving you are like some degraded, blurry, you know, 8-bit picture. It's ridiculous. And what you're pointing out in the difference in the images, again, anyone can go on the internet and search for the earliest images of the moon, and you will see how 3D, it looks like it's crafted out of a 3D clay. That's how three-dimensional it looks. And then look at modern images, and you'll see there's a huge discrepancy.
Now, you've spent an insane amount of time behind a telescope looking at the moon.
Yep.
What does the moon look like to you through the telescope compared to the images that are shown to us?
So here's the thing. They look different. That's all there is to it. But here's the thing. I used to watch, and my wife, Croette, used to watch. And at one point, I remember saying to her, you know, on some nights we come out to watch and the moon has a more 3D appearance. Now, I'm not talking about the same 3D appearance as the old moon images. I'm just talking about a slight shift. It looks a little more three-dimensional. Now, the average person will think it's because of the lighting. This is not the case. A fully lit moon or a nearly fully lit moon is subject to what I'm talking about. At which point she told me I noticed that too. So then I ended up talking to Randy in Houston, who had also noticed it. But there was a whole other thing going on here. There was times when we would look at a fully lit moon and one portion would be out of focus. And so we would focus it for that portion and what we were just looking at went out of focus. And again, my wife noticed this, and then I talked to Randy in Houston, and then I talked to other people. A bunch of people had noticed this. The problem here is that even if the moon were a curved sphere in space, there's not enough curvature to account for the focus discrepancy. So there's something else going on there. But to answer your question directly, the moon looks different, and almost when I switch cameras, the images look different from each other. That's how strange this is.
What about the difference between film and digital?
Again, there's a big difference. When I was shooting with film, part of the problem with film is you only get one try. You know, you can't see what you've shot until you develop it. And so a lot of them are not exposed perfectly. But when I was shooting with film back then, what I remember was a much more three-dimensional appearance, particularly in a moon that wasn't fully lit.
Is that just due to the nature of the medium?
I don't think so. I think it's something else altogether. As a matter of fact, I would not be surprised to learn that someone looking at the moon 20 years ago had a very different experience than someone looking at the moon now.
You know, that's an interesting question. Maybe we should just find some old astronomers, you know, people who sit in front of these giant telescopes and say, hey, what does it look like to you today compared to 30 years ago?
Well, here's something anyone can do. I once did a video to try to demonstrate the moon's not a quarter of a million miles away from us, roughly. There's a crater called Aristarchus, which for most of us appears in the upper left when the moon is near fully lit. The moon needs to be near fully lit. It's a little white crater called Aristarchus. We're told it's approximately 40 miles in diameter. By the way, this is a naked eye object. In other words, if I have just my eyes and I'm standing on Earth, I can see this a quarter of a million miles away, this 40 mile in diameter white dot. Go on the internet and look up images for the Aristarchus crater. You will quickly discover that no two moon maps, no two images, no two anything look the same when you look at Aristarchus crater, and this illustrates the point I think you're getting at. I mean, no two. You cannot find two images taken on different occasions that even approach where someone would say, oh yeah, that's the thing I just looked at. They look that vastly different, and the moon maps are no different. Look at any three moon maps and you'll see that, you know, there are so many discrepancies.
What about two people standing next to each other looking at the moon the same night and one pointing to the other an object? Do you think their own visual cues would be different?
I don't know, man. I mean, you know, if you want to go down the road that we're living in the Matrix, you can really start to crack open that question.
That's kind of what I'm getting at, yeah.
Yeah, the only, you know, then we're talking about our mind making our reality. So the question becomes, does one person's mind make the same reality as the next one's? But I think it's a bit like the Mandela effect. Really, the only way you could ever start to demonstrate that is for two people to take an image with identical equipment and then sit down and look at it. But as I've pointed out, every time you change telescope and camera, the moon looks different.
And that says a lot right there. So we're almost up to modern time. We're at 2009. We see the Kepler spacecraft is supposed to be seeking planets outside of our solar system. And, of course, from that point on, we see, I believe they're in the hundreds now, if I remember.
Thousands, yeah.
Thousands, yeah. Just claiming that, oh, yeah, we found all these different planets and different orbits around all these different stars.
So what you're looking at with the Kepler is a complete mental programming. Not only is it reinforcing your idea of space and your idea of planets, but it is also doing another insidious thing. It's putting this idea in your mind that, wow, there's all these other planets that people or things could be living on. But what it's really doing that's insidious is it's denying you an ability to understand where you exist. You see, if you talk about a light year, nobody listening to this program can wrap their mind around what a light year is. We know that it's supposed to be the distance that light would travel over a year. But nobody can put that in a frame of reference. So in essence, what they're doing to you is putting you in an environment where you have no ability to place yourself, to center yourself, to exist. They're denying you the ability to wrap your mind around where you are. And every astronomy book I have ever seen, the 101 astronomy book, starts out by demonstrating we're going to be talking about distances that are so vast you can't wrap your head around it. And they use all these clever ways with, you know, miles and football fields and all these other things to try to show you you have no concept of the distances and can't have any concept of the distances. In essence, what this does to a human being is it denies you understanding where you exist. If you do not understand where you exist, you've been denied one of the most basic things. It's a bit like being denied knowledge of how we got here, how long we've been here. All these things put together that we have been denied, which are our birthright, make us a much more controllable species, and it also has an effect on where do we go from here. Well, if we don't know where we are, how do we know where we can go to? These kinds of ideas. And there are other researchers that would agree with me now that you can absolutely get your mind around where we are. The sun and moon are way, 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 way closer than you have been told. Probably within a couple 2,000 to 3,000 miles, if I had to venture a guess, and that is a guess, but much closer than the 93 million and quarter of a million you've been told. When you start to consider this, that we're in an enclosed environment, that the sun and moon are much closer, all of a sudden you can wrap your head around where you exist. Hey man, I can, this is a concept I can understand. I can understand that a few thousand miles away, this thing exists. And it's not as big as I've been told. Now you start to center where you exist. And I know that was kind of a labored explanation, but I thought it was important because from the outset of Kepler, I've really had problems because it's just a programming tool, not to mention it doesn't exist in space.
And speaking of programming tools, in 2010 is when we see these two private companies we discussed earlier, Virgin Galactic and SpaceX, publicly announcing efforts to becoming spacefaring organizations and being open to the public at some point.
Right on, man. I look forward to all that fake video. You know, it's like the International Space Station video. There is no video provided to the public from there that cannot, you know, when scrutinized, doesn't fall apart. It just doesn't. And when you see these companies doing this, they're kicking the can down the road. But when you start to say publicly announcing efforts become spacefaring organizations, you got to wonder, are the shackles that close to be putting on us all where these lies will no longer matter? Or is it just going to be another one of these things where they kick the can down the road and something comes up that interferes? Because we're not spacefaring. You can go on the internet today on YouTube and look up, I think, 4 to 5 separate astronauts admitting that the purpose to the Orion space missions was to create a way for humans to finally go beyond low Earth orbit. So here, NASA's telling us they've been to the moon, they've been all these things out to planets taking pictures, and there's an astronaut looking you in the eye, not just one, but I think at least 4, saying the Orion capsules that we have made now are going to allow us to, for the first time, leave low Earth orbit. This is all a sham. And so when you see these companies doing this kind of thing, it's something to watch because it is a bellwether of something. I'm just not sure what.
Well, even that statement is going off the assumption that, okay, we did bullshit everything up to this point. But space,
that's right.
But space really is the way you think it is. So the Orion spacecraft is just, we finally figured out how to get through space. It's assuming that space is the way that it's always been talked about. We just bullshitted the previous programs.
That's right. But they're also, you know, kind of obscuring what the supposed Van Allen radiation belts are. You know, we have one of the Apollo astronauts saying, I don't think we went through the belts. Then when he's corrected, he's all, I don't remember going through the belts. And then it's clear he's lying. But then they're using the idea that, well, part of the problem is we got to get through these Van Allen belts. Well, you know what, guys? I don't accept your Van Allen belts. I know for a fact, for myself, that nothing has been beyond low Earth orbit unless there is some super secret other means of travel that we have never heard of or seen anything from. In my mind, that's the only possibilities that exist.
And that very well may be, you know?
I don't know, but I have a feeling if that were the case, we would be talking more about maybe dimensional or something like that. It sure does appear that space is something we can't go into, almost like if you want to go down deep in the ocean at some point, you just can't because the environment won't let you. Or maybe it's more like we're tuned to here, you know, frequency tuned. And if you get outside our little bubble, whatever it is, you would be untuned and you wouldn't be able to exist. These kinds of ideas are kind of how I think about space, even though I've come to say it may well be a liquid or water. That doesn't tell us much.
No, you may be onto something with a higher mathematics there that it is a fact, and I know this very well, as do you, being a musician, that everything is frequency. And that may have a lot more to do with our physical reality than most people can really grasp. And that
we could exist
here where we're at now because of the frequencies we're at, but we can't go there because the frequencies are too different from our existence, and we just couldn't function there. Our waveforms could not coincide with those waveforms.
That's right. It's a jail without bars. And this was part of my interest in the early Hattie-Bov work that, James Alfred ended up doing so much with. These ideas of octaves and these ideas that you are a part of your environment. Therefore, your basic frequency makeup must be in tune with this place. And that if you went away from this place, there may be a different frequency makeup, which in and of itself is a prison. There's no way to get around that. That we could see currently.
That also, let's just conjecture that aliens do come and visit us here. It actually makes more sense that the kind of spacecraft that would be being used are shifting frequencies and dimensional hopping as opposed to faster than light travel and, you know, doing the Enterprise kind of thing and just going really fast between planets. It actually makes a little more sense, you know?
Sure, but I mean, the problem is one of my rules that I live by. We live in the high-definition age. Anything amazing that can be filmed will be filmed. Where's our evidence? So that really starts to leave you, the alien idea leaves you with two basic ideas when you take it logically down this road, that they are so advanced that we're no better than ants. In the same way that I could walk over to an ant and pick it up off the ground out of the line of ants it's following and then put it back down and it would just start following its ants. Did that ant know that I abducted it? Did he know he was temporarily abducted? So if that possibility exists, then I suppose maybe we could think about aliens in some way. My problem is this. We're logically providing for aliens, but there is no evidence that we can see other than things we see in the sky, but we can't identify. My wife's seen them. I've seen them. She has a slightly different view on me. I kind of tend to think it's probably all human technology. I think she maybe doesn't agree with me on these points, but my point would be, at what point do all these cameras on planet Earth at least provide us something that says, wait a minute, this is so far beyond what a human being could do, and we don't have these things. And then, of course, the Tavistock research, where there's documents that show they started as a social engineering endeavor, the whole Roswell on the 33rd parallel thing and the whole alien agenda.
Right, and we know that there's a lot of that that has
there's
gone
a
on
lot
and still
of that,
is going
yeah.
on.
So, and you never know at what point lies are being mixed with truths to cover the truths, but when I'm faced with a situation like that, I take the simplest answer. I take Occam's razor.
And that's what we have to do. I mean, everybody's got an iPhone of some sort in their pocket. Like, okay,
that's right.
let's shoot the damn thing and let's see it.
That's right.
2011 has the Shuttle Atlantis being the last of the space shuttle launches. After that, the program is done. The ISS has been in constant use for years now. It's got a purported usage date until 2020, but there are discussions supposed to be going on now to extend that. So this gets back to what I said earlier. The big question, why has no one taken an iPhone into space and filmed everything, pointed out the window, pointed at the Earth, pointed at the stars, pointed at the moon? It would be an incredibly easy thing to do.
Right.
All these different nations, like iPhone technology or whatever smartphone you got, it's incredibly common now. Most people have something in their pocket.
Well, there's no way around it. I mean, see, one of the arguments could be, well, you can't take it out in space because the radiation would, you know, destroy the image. You know, they even used that during the Apollo missions. As a matter of fact, there were people who said it would have been impossible for the film to work in the Apollo missions because of the radiation we were being told about. But you make a good point. If you're in the International Space Station and you go up to the observing portal thing they claim they have, why aren't you taking the best damn pictures of Jupiter or a star cluster or a globular cluster galaxy, anything? And they don't. And this is telling, because anyone, any sane human being that was put in that position, the first thing you'd think about doing was taking a camera with you. I mean, who wouldn't?
Tell me that nobody would stand in front of that window with this amazing Earth backdrop and take a bunch of selfies and say, look where I was. That's what people do nowadays, no matter where you go.
That's right.
I call bullshit.
It's total BS. And not only that, for people listening who may not fully grasp that the International Space Station is absolute fraud and does not exist, go look on YouTube at the work that has been done. There are so many egregious things done in the videos of the supposed astronauts. Everything from women being hung upside down. You can see their swollen, squinty eyes and their swollen faces so that their hair will be sticking straight up. And from that to even having so much hairspray applied to their hair that it's like concrete because it can't be laying down in a zero-G environment. And this is just a couple of examples of the egregious things that have been done to kind of show. I have one posted where I showed the edit marks that they used that was shot on the Vomit Comet. So you get about 30 seconds of weightlessness. And I proved flat out, even in the cuts, all of a sudden objects would be in frame that weren't there before the cut. And they're making the person look like it was a continuous thing. So it proves the fakery, and there's no reason for it. Just go on YouTube and look at the ISS debunking, and no thinking person can walk away, you know, understanding that nonsense is going on there.
Right. And to tie this up, what have people captured with their iPhones in their pockets? Well, you yourself had a listener, a fan of yours, send you in video that she shot of rockets not going to space, but actually arcing out and going over their own heads.
That's right. And not only that, there are a number of images where someone held the shutter open, so it shows the whole parabolic arc of the rocket. Anyone, and it's funny, you'll see these things posted online, and it says rocket taking satellite to orbit, and you can see that it's going up, hitting apex, and coming down. Again, we have to revert back to one of the laws I live by. Anything amazing that can be filmed will be filmed in the modern age in high definition. Why don't we have anything doing the supposed burn back into our atmosphere? That would be an incredible piece of video. And even with the equipment I have, I could capture something like that if I was in the right location. Why don't we have anything escaping from our environment on HD video? We don't. We have some fakes, but there it is.
I think it would be absolutely incredible to see someone just point their iPhone out the main window of a command module as it's making its reentry. That would look just absolutely incredible, and we've never seen it.
And you, I don't know. I mean, at some point, the technology is going to be so good that the game we play of ripping apart, you know, that's one thing that's kind of always vexed me. Hollywood is so closely entrenched in all this fraud, and yet so much of the International Space video looks like Junior did it on his laptop. You know, it's done okay, but it doesn't stand up to scrutiny. And you've got to wonder, because if someone took the movie Gravity and never realized it was made by Hollywood, you would believe 100% that was shot in space. It's that good, you know?
Well, and that's almost it. It's almost like they're giving us the middle finger, you know? It's like it looks like crap. It's like, no, Hollywood could make you a NASA better than NASA, you know? And you will believe it, you know?
I guess it's a numbers game, you know, as long as you got 100 million who don't get it, the 10,000 that do don't make much of a difference.
Maybe that's what it comes down to. They don't have to do that good of a job, you know. I'm just waiting for that one person who finally blows the whistle on this whole thing, because it's got to happen sooner or later.
There's no doubt. We're in a change of our times. And, you know, we always use the kind of cheesy allegory from the movie They Live. A lot of us got the glasses now. A lot of us can see. So you've got to imagine at some point something has to give.
And that's kind of where I want to tie this up. You know, there's tons of YouTube channels as well as other mediums being used to just dissect everything that we've been given. And folks, do your homework. You'll find out that things aren't what we've been told.
You know, there is no doubt. And Jason, I want to thank you for coming on and counterpointing. I just flew back from the West Coast. I'm a bit jet lagged, so I truly appreciate you helping me keep this on track, because I'm feeling pretty beat up. I need another day to recover, but I needed to get a show out. Anyhow, we kind of decided between us to come at the space fraud in a different way than I normally would. I hope it's provided some things for people to think about, some things to look into, where you too can come to the conclusions about some of the falsehoods we've been told, I mean, our whole lives. Anyhow, before we close out, Jason, is there anything you'd like to add?
I think we covered the whole thing. And, you know, everything we discussed, I did in a few hours last night, just doing searches, and put this extensive list together. And I even skipped things because I knew we had to fit it into a two-hour program. And, you know, I just sat here with my iPhone and my iPad making notes, Googling things, basically. And I did this in a very short amount of time and found all of these inconsistencies so that we could have this discussion today. If I did that in a short amount of time, just think what people could do by actually putting in some serious effort, which is what I'm going to do with the whole Social Security Death Index thing.
There it is, man. There is another truth that people can live by in the modern age. There is no hoax that will not be destroyed by the weight of the details. There are some things in this world that are facts. One of those facts is you cannot make a true thing false, and you cannot make a false thing true. As long as the world we live in provides that reality, there is no hoax that can be pulled in front of our eyes that will not be destroyed by people taking its details apart under careful scrutiny. Anyhow, that brings episode 38 to a close. Space, the fraud of generations. There it is, man. Cheers.